If you lost Survivor and you're feeling down, David and Jessica will turn it around. They'll break down the rules and they'll show you how. You played yourself and got voted out. This is why Blank lost. And this is why Blank lost. Oh baby, this is why Blank lost.
Welcome to this week's edition of Why Blank Lost, or in this case, Why Blank Won for the finale. I'm David Bloomberg, and even though the Spy Nest returned once again for the Survivor finale, I decided to just start this podcast sitting right here. Looks like my co-host Jessica Lewis is doing the same thing, and I hope she's ready and buckled in because this is going to be a long ride.
Let me tell you, there is so much information crammed into my brain right now. I hope we can get through this and I remember everything I want to talk about because... yeah, there was so much happening, so many things to talk about, so many people to talk about. So this will be a very long podcast. So yeah, get ready. Everybody needs to get ready.
You better be ready. We're coming for you.
That's right. You should have sang that.
Nah, not this
you
time.
You did before.
I did before. It was a one-time deal. So we have a winner.
We do have a winner.
I was right in at least that part of my prediction from last week.
Oh, Lord. Here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm even wearing a classic Survivor t-shirt that goes back to Heroes versus Villains days. So let me, here you go.
It's perfect.
Yes. I debated whether or not Tony was a villain and decided that he certainly was in his first season because remember that Sarah learned she had to play like a criminal in order to win. And she learned that from him.
Right.
And I'd say he carried that over to the season, even if he was a celebrated and loved villain.
Yes, it's very interesting because he was talked about by Denise and she compared him to Ted Bundy, which I thought, right. And that was exactly Rob's response to when she called him Ted Bundy. But if you really think about it, Ted Bundy, granted, Tony's not a serial killer, but, you know, he was taking people out of the game and, you know, ending their Survivor games, if you will. And people loved him anyway. And Ted Bundy had this weird effect on people where they were like, oh, he's on trial for murder, but isn't he so cute? And I want to go watch him. And, you know, like there's this weird like thing happening. And
yeah,
and
that is a weird thing.
But it was interesting to hear her say that because it really did kind of resonate, I think, with his game and that he was able to take so many people out. And they continued to just kind of be in awe of him and be impressed with him and be wanting to watch him play and see him perform at Tribal Council. And so it was an incredible feat and a fun thing to watch. And so when I heard that analogy, I was like, oh, that's interesting because sometimes people just have an effect on those around them. And I think Tony really pulled it off this season and just had that effect on people where they were literally in awe of him.
We'll have the next, 3 hours or so to discuss a lot of that, I have a feeling.
Sure.
That's just a guess, people. I have no idea for sure. But at the finale, anyone who followed your advice at the end of every podcast where you say follow us on Twitter and we live tweet. So anyone who saw me live tweeting the finale knows the highs and lows that I went through. Even now, I haven't decided if that made it a great finale or a dreadful one because I was definitely emotionally invested, which suggests it was great. But I also feared and dreaded that the whole season would be ruined by the Edge returnee winning, even though logic told me Tony would win by the time we got to the final three. I just couldn't allow myself to believe it until I saw that sixth vote for him and realized that all the rest were for him, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, the worry and anger I felt when I thought it might go the other way just drained me, took it out of me.
Yes, it was an interesting thing to watch unfold because we had already all experienced that with the Chris Underwood win, which again, not discounting his win. We don't like the Edge and we've talked about that quite a bit. But then to see it like almost happening again, I think everyone was in that headspace thinking, oh my gosh, this could happen with an all-winner season. And these are winners who came into this game hating the idea of Edge of Extinction. I mean, it Tony himself was calling it gross in his mm-hmm. pregame interviews that the Chris Underwood win and how gross that was. And people had very strong opinions of it before they walked in here. And I realize a lot of them talked about it in their exit interviews or the Jury Speaks videos, that you have to play the game that you were dealt. And Edge of Extinction was part of the game that they were dealt and what they had to play with. But I thought it was an interesting thing to really kind of process, that though that was part of the game that they were dealt, that doesn't discount the game itself, because right. that's still there. It's still yeah. outwit, outplay, outlast. So those things shouldn't be pushed aside just because now the Edge of Extinction exists. Outwit, outplay, outlast has been the resonating theme of Survivor for its entirety. So you have to play with everything, not just because now the Edge is here. We have to consider that too. We have to consider right. old school Survivor too. Old school old Survivor, school. Right? So, yes. you know, there was a lot
on
of
the back,
mixed emotions.
Does it say never? Does it say never Edger on the back?
No, but it probably should. No, it's so to me, that was something that I just kept kind of going over in my head with all of this, is that I understand the Edge and the desire to let people back in the game, and that has to be part of what they're all dealing with. But we still cannot be forgetting the game that is without the Edge and what always has been without the Edge. So,
right. Okay.
It's a lot to process.
Yeah. Well, since that draining finale, I've tried to rest up. It's funny because I say I've rested up and regained my strength, but really, you know, I've spent the last however many days going through interviews and mm-hmm. CBS All Access clips right. and Jury Speaks videos, social media. Like I said at the beginning, interviews. We finally got interviews.
I know.
But, you know, we have six players from the finale to compare their games to the rules that I originally wrote way back after season one. And, you know, of course, have been modifying ever since. Using that in all that information. So the latest version of the rules, if you're at the finale here and still looking for it, is robhaswebsite.com/blog/survivor rules. And I know there are people out there who read it, because we've gotten a couple of questions for next week's podcast mm-hmm. based on it says here in the rules. And I'm like, wow, good for you.
You're like, yes,
I appreciate that.
Pat on your back there. It's
yeah.
good.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, those rules are out there. Or you can get the shorter and much more colorful version of the rules in poster form at tinyurl.com/DavidRulesPoster2.
That's right.
Now, we've noted for a little while now that just as Rob has been donating to Direct Relief, an organization that provides protective equipment for doctors and nurses, we were donating the proceeds for every poster we sold in April and now the first 2 weeks of May to the same charity. We went ahead and donated $300. All the proceeds to the GoFundMe Rob set up. Anyone who wants to know that GoFundMe address, hit me up on Twitter. I'll send it to you. It's still available. But if anyone was waiting till the absolute last minute, or you're just tuning into this podcast now for the first time, you just found us on YouTube or wherever else, we'll make another donation for all the proceeds for the next few days too. So hurry up and get yours now. Again, that's tinyurl.com/DavidRulesPoster2.
Yes. And it looks wonderful in a frame, as you can see here.
So, maybe we can see. I'm not sure where, you know, the framing will be there.
No, but that's yeah. true. But
they could always, you know.
It's here. So, it's definitely it's here.
So, yeah. And in addition to the poster, everyone probably knows by now, unless, again, you're new, that we also have another way to get the rules. So you can always have them with you in T-shirt form.
Mm-hmm.
Just go to robhaswebsite.com or robhasapodcast.com and click the merch link near the top. Sort the store so new items are first, and the shirts will be right there. We have both men's and women's T-shirts available.
Yes, they look great. It's really, really
yes,
nice.
They do. Mm-hmm. They do. So I've gotten some people sending pictures and the like, and you know, of course, all of our listeners are awesome, beautiful, wonderful people. They look even better in those shirts.
Exactly, a
scientific study has shown it.
Yeah, it's just a fact. That's all. Yes. Just a fact. Yes.
So I already mentioned this once, but before we get to the rules, we mentioned last week we will once again have a postseason Q&A podcast about a week after our finale podcast. We've already gotten questions, so if you have some to add, make sure you get them to us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to miss out on anyone. So normally we cover some other topics before we get to the rules, but we have to talk about six people, mm-hmm. and everything will be discussed in there somewhere. I do want to note that, unfortunately, as often happens in the finale podcast, we won't be able to cover every member of the final six in as much detail as we normally do when there's a podcast dedicated to each of them, because then it would be like a 6 or 7 hour podcast.
Oh, my goodness. I would need some
Yes. Yeah. But we will hit all of the most important parts.
Yes.
So I also want to mention something that you've already brought up. But I want to, just before we get to the rules, many jurors said Natalie played a great Edge of Extinction game,
mm-hmm.
but they also noted it's a different game. Sophie said it was like comparing an apple and an orange.
Mm-hmm.
Adam said they were in different universes. As anyone who has listened to us for any length of time, including like 5 minutes ago, knows, we can't stand Edge of Extinction. There's just no two ways about it. However, we are forced to deal with it again here as we discuss what happened in the game. Thankfully, we don't have to talk once again about someone coming back from the edge to win, because I don't think my blood pressure could take it, and YouTube might have thrown us off for the words we'd be using. But,
yes.
You know, we're not going to be talking about challenge performance and dragging logs. Natalie did great at that, but that is not playing Survivor.
I mean, I do think that she tried to respond to those concerns and those complaints that people might have. And we'll
address those.
Right. We'll get there. But it is. I loved the apples and orange analogy. I loved mm-hmm. what Adam said about it, that it's almost impossible to compare Tony's game and Natalie's game because they literally were playing different games. I thought that was spot on. So. Absolutely, there are some definite issues with that comparison, but we're going to mm-hmm. get through it as best as we can. So.
Yeah, yeah. So let's move on to the rules. Tony came into this season almost universally expected to go out early as a big threat.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he did not receive a single vote against him the whole season. How did he do it? What did other people think of his game? And how did the other members of the final six do in their own attempts to come up with the $2 million prize? It's time to figure out why Tony won, why Michelle, Sarah, Ben, and Denise lost, and why Natalie lost again.
I was wondering. I'm like, wait a second. That was a good little twist there.
Yes. Now, we occasionally go through the rules out of order when the situation demands it. We've never done it for the finale, in part because we have six different people to discuss. Today, we have a special case, as everyone thought Tony would be voted out quickly because of his threat level coming in, and the sixth rule warns against being too much of a threat. This was clearly the biggest obstacle he had to overcome, and a lot of the rest of what we'll be discussing stems from this point. For returning player seasons, we often hear, well, there was nothing that person could do because they came in as a huge threat. Tony proved that to be untrue.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a few others who have found a way to overcome it, like Tyson in Blood versus Water when he acted like his shoulder injury was far worse than it actually was, or Boston Rob when he just steamrolled to his win. But in full returning player seasons, well-known, active, out-in-front players like Tony are just not expected to win.
Mm-hmm.
Tony learned from his brief, very brief, Game Changers experience and came in determined to reduce his own threat level. He went about it in a number of ways. He didn't look for idols. He wasn't acting crazy in a game way. He went along with others to show he didn't want to be in the power position, always asking what other people wanted to do. He even said in interviews that he altered the way he acted physically,
yes.
such as, you know, talking to people from a lower point on the ground, slouching his shoulders, using smaller hand gestures.
Mm-hmm.
As he told Mike Bloom, all those subtle things disarm people subconsciously. It makes them think he's not threatening.
I was fascinated when I read that component of his interview, not crossing his arms. Those are the types of things that show he was thinking about everything.
Right.
He wasn't just thinking about strategic decisions. He was actually thinking about how he was being perceived. And we've said it so many times. Perception in Survivor is reality, unfortunately, mm-hmm. because what people see is what they end up deciding their votes on. And if they are perceiving him as non-threatening because of the way he's presenting himself to them, then he's in such a better strategic spot with that person because they're willing to listen to him and he's not telling them what to do. It was great to see Tony in a place of accepting information from people. Like, even when we were screaming at the TV saying, you are so wrong right now about, you know, when everyone was convinced that Natalie didn't have an idol coming back off the edge and everyone was yelling at their televisions and Tony was getting frustrated that no one was listening to him, but he was still like, okay. No, if that's what you think, all right, that's fine. And yeah. It was interesting to see that because he knew that that's not what should be happening, but he still did not push. And I loved that about his game because it was a completely different Tony. But so it was like he checked all the boxes, everything he needed to do in order to play with these people.
Yeah. And he said after the game that he knew he had to play under the radar for at least the first half. Mm-hmm. So he was being fun and goofy, you know, the ladder and everything else, instead of being scary. As he told his wife at the family visit, he was in house arrest. And then he told her, and that's why I'm still here. He said he's not threatening when you get to know him. So he made sure to talk to people so that could happen, which, of course, we'll discuss in the fifth.
Yes. And I do think that the fact that he recognized all of these things about him going into an all winter season. I mean, once he understood that this was an all winter season, he also utilized his information of other people in comparison to himself to also reduce his threat level because he saw potential people that he was playing with. And then when he actually saw them before they went out and played the game, he knew that there was other egos out there and he knew that there were other people that were going to be bigger targets than himself. So he used that to his advantage as well. Like, I'm going to minimize my threat level and I'm going to kind of elevate theirs at the same time. So it was a really interesting dynamic because he should have been on that same exact level with them, but he was able to minimize his own and increase other people at the same time.
Yeah. You know, and the players recognized what he had done. You know, Adam said in his Jury Speaks video that Tony came in with among the highest threat levels. So the fact that he made it without ever being voted for is pretty outrageous, is what he said. He was able to adapt his game early on so people didn't fear him as much. He laid low, took his time, connected with people on personal level, didn't run off and game too hard, and then he turned it on.
Yes.
You know, that was all Adam saying that. Wendell said in his Jury Speaks video that Tony minimized his threat level and played a masterful game and had done amazing things to minimize his target.
It was really incredible to see everyone appreciating the type of game that Tony played because it was unexpected. And I think that's why there was more appreciation for it as well. You know, people were looking at Tony and thinking he's going to come in and be crazy running around. And you don't want to necessarily play with Tony because he's kind of out there and he does a lot of insane things. And so there was this concern with Tony. I think when you look at a lot of his pregame interview, you know, what people said about him, whereas someone like Sarah, and I know we haven't gone to her yet, but you kind of look at the different interpretation that people had of how Sarah was going to be perceived coming in versus how Tony was going to be perceived.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting to see that they didn't expect this Tony. And I think that caught them off guard. I really think that it caught people off guard.
Yeah, nobody expected this Tony.
Right.
You know, when we did our Why the Winners Lost preview podcast, I mentioned that with there being more obvious threats around the season compared to Game Changers, where he was one of the top. Now, this time he was still one of the top, but there were more of them. If he stayed calm, he might actually make it a little deeper. Then in our general preview podcast, I said Tony's arc in the game would depend on if he held true to what he was telling the media about how he was going to play things slow this time. And I questioned whether he could tone it down.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he'd be able to for a little while, but I said, you can't box up Tony, and said that if he had a solid alliance by that point, then he could be okay. Turned out I was right. And he even knew he couldn't stay boxed up the whole game. So he planned for that.
Right.
He set things up to avoid being seen as a threat and then turned it on when he needed to. And when he had his alliances, you know, and then when that happened, Jeremy noted that Tony was the biggest threat out there. But by that time, all of all of Tony's pieces were in place.
And he credited his game and Game Changers with how he was able to understand how to play this time. Because, I mean, his win in Kageon was shocking, I think, to a lot of people, because you don't normally see a winner play as he did in Kageon. But then he learned from Game Changers that he can't do that again. And so I don't know if we would have had, I highly doubt we would have had this Tony if he hadn't had that loss in Game Changers, because it taught him so much about how he needs to play this game versus what he thought he could do after Kageon. So it was an interesting thing to see him process and work through it, and also credit to his wife for helping him. She really kind of coached him. Yes, Baby Cakes helped him out big time with how he needed to approach this game.
Yes. Now, you know, Michelle, on the other hand, came in with almost no threat level. Just as Aubrey talked about how she was seen as a threat in Game Changers because the others there felt she should have won, Michelle was the opposite, as she discussed several times throughout the season. Yes, other players consoled her and told her a win is a win, but even in their minds, there are different levels of threatening gameplay. Mm-hmm. Michelle wanted to play more forcefully this time, as we'll discuss later, but she never put herself in a position where the others considered her a threat, whether by design or happenstance.
And I think this is something that a lot of people touched upon in their Jury Speaks videos, is that even though we can appreciate the fact that she was able to get to the end, I feel like some people thought, well, she was able to get to the end because she was maneuvering herself through all of these people who were more threatening than she was. Mm-hmm. And so she ended up being able to stay in the game much longer because nobody really looked at her as a threat, because not only did she not come in as a threat, but also she didn't have a core group of people that she was playing the game with, which would have created more of a threat because she came with others. She was really kind of on her own, kind of floating around the various people who she was playing the game with that were much more threatening than she was perceived to be.
Yeah. In our preseason podcast, I noticed that it was possible the less threatening players could be targeted because they often win all returning player seasons. And Michelle recognized her position coming in too, saying, these are super fans out here too, and they have their finger on the pulse of what's happening in these returning seasons, which by trend seem to be taken over by under the radar players. If that's their mindset going in, then my ship might be sunk before I even leave the port. I noted then that even if others do that, I thought that there were more threatening, less threatening people. And indeed, that was the case for her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Michelle probably should have utilized those people more to her benefit. I know she tried to kind of rally the troops, but it's one of those situations where, you know, I know that Tony talked about it a lot in his pregame interviews, that he wanted to actually round up those stragglers, basically those people who others won't necessarily.
You're getting ahead again.
I know, but I feel like, you know, for Michelle, she saw this in herself, and the difference between she and Tony is she saw what her threat level was coming in, but I don't think she utilized it to her benefit. Like Tony saw his threat level coming in and was able to change it up so it worked for him. And I don't think Michelle ended up doing the same thing.
Yeah. Now, as we move on to Natalie, we already covered her first couple days in our first podcast of the season, so we'll only be discussing her return. Obviously, as the Edge of Extinction player, the others knew she represented a threat because they saw what happened with Chris Underwood. But that never mattered because there was literally never a time when they could do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
She came in with an immunity idol, found another one, and won immunity. So she never had to actually save herself by playing the strategic game to try to minimize her threat level.
I mean, she did, I think, come in and had a plan. But yes, it wasn't about having to minimize her threat level, because she, I think, even tried to make it seem as if the people on the Edge of Extinction didn't like her, which I think could have been to her benefit, because if you think about it, what have we talked about with Edge of Extinction? You know, that's part of the concern, is that she's been building a relationship with these people. And so her threat level, as far as the likability factor with the people that she's been on the edge with, could have been a concern. And she tried to downplay that. So at least she did try to get them to think that, oh, well, we don't need to worry about her getting jury votes because they hung out with her for 35 days. So I think there was a little bit of work that she was doing there, at least.
Yeah, but it didn't matter.
No, it didn't matter. But she, you know, But right, she doesn't want to walk in and be like, hey, I have an idol. Right. Look what I've got. You know, right. Instead, she was trying to make it about something else.
Yeah. Moving to Ben, he came in thinking the others would see him as a threat. So he wanted to keep around other big threats like Rob, Tony, Jeremy, and Wendell. I said in the preseason podcast that a plan like that could work early if the idea of threats banding together managed to get off the ground. But I thought it was doomed to disaster later when the others eventually tossed him aside as not being quite up to their threat level. So I was half right. Some viewers chuckled when Ben talked in the game about keeping the threats and put himself in those ranks, but it ended up working for him for a long time.
Yeah, I feel like Ben's threat level was an interesting one coming into this game because of the win that he did end up getting and was kind of controversial, right? And he's acknowledged that too. Not that he wasn't a threat in his previous season. He played his ass off in his season and right. really worked very, very hard. So I think that the reason why people kind of reflected on it and thought, well, no, he's really not as threatening as he might think he is because his win was controversial. So I think he might have lost some of the, no, Ben really is a threat because the guy knows how to find idols. He wins immunities. You know, like he really is a great player because he's going for it and he wants to win and he's going to push. So unfortunately for Ben, I think that his approach ended up, again, it was kind of similar to Michelle. I think it worked against him because he didn't really recognize what he was coming into the game needing to do, as opposed to what Tony came in realizing what he needed to do. He almost overcompensated.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you just mentioned Michelle, and much like Michelle, I don't think anyone really thought of Denise as a huge threat coming into the game, but that changed somewhat when she became the Queen Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after that happened, I thought the others might get rid of her. But as a matter of fact, I think I predicted it at least once or twice, but that never materialized and she sailed through to the finale along with her alliance. Now, Denise said in her social media Q&A that you don't want people to think they can't beat you in the finale. And some people may have worried a little about that because she took out Sandra. But in the end, I don't think that ever really mattered. So much had happened in the game between those two points. It wasn't the reason she got voted out.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of questioned that because when we got to the whether or not they should vote out the Denise versus Sarah moment, mm-hmm. you know, when there was that potential tie between the two of them, if they were going to have to go to fire, that the choice, why there was the choice of Denise versus Sarah, because she didn't come across as someone who was as threatening as Sarah was in going to a final three. And so I did wonder if there was any thought put to, well, she's got a resume. She at least does have a resume that's her own. It wasn't something that, like, Sarah's sharing her resume with Tony, whereas Denise had a move that was completely 100% her own move, and it was taking out Sandra. So in this particular season, when you're playing with all winners, I do think that a move like that would generate a lot of respect with the jury because they are winners. And when you have a big move that you've pulled off, I think that gains you a lot of points. So I was very curious if that was something that came into their consideration, but we found out, I think, from exit interviews that it did not.
Right. So, yes. Yes. Yeah. And we'll find out what that reason is.
Yes, we'll stay get tuned. There. Stay tuned.
All right. Now we can go back
hours from here.
That's right. Now we can go back to the usual order of things with the first and generally most important rule, which talks about the need to scheme and plot. The only reason this wasn't still the most important rule for Tony this season was that in order to even get to the point of strategy, he had to make it past his own threat level, as we just discussed. Once he did that, and for everyone else throughout the game, this rule continued to be of prime importance. Now, as we saw throughout the season, all six of these players understood that, though they each went about it in their different ways. To discuss Tony, let's start by going to Nick in his Jury Speaks video, where he said Tony understands the strategic elements of the game and how important tight alliances are. I mean, yes, obviously he does. He came in with pregame alliances with Sandra and Sarah. It was lucky enough to have both on his starting tribe.
Oh, that is ridiculous. I'm sorry. I was just looking at the divisions and how they created the tribes. Oh, and I was like, yeah. I'm like, wait, they really did that. Like, they really put them on the same tribe together. Like, come on.
Split I mean, there's lots up. Of consideration. Yeah, I don't know.
I know.
But it also certainly helped that Ewell immediately wanted to work with them to target the so-called Poker Alliance, which, you know, helped to take some initial heat off of him. That gave him time to do what we just talked about in terms of reducing his threat level, solidifying bonds. And then in his own words from his social media Q&A, he played an honest game as much as he could, but also played a dishonest game. If he had to lie, he lied. If he had to be honest, he was honest. Once he really got going, he worked to win by taking control, dictating the game, making the moves that would work for him, and not worrying about that word that you just said, the R word, not worrying about building a resume, because he knew his game would speak for him. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very interesting that he said, when you're trying to build a resume, your timing is usually off. He wanted to just concentrate on getting ahead each time he voted someone off.
Yes. One of the things he said in his pregame interviews, too, was that he wanted to play the players, which I thought was really an interesting way to go about this, that it wasn't about playing the game. He knew that he needed to actually play with those particular people that he was going to be with and utilize them in order to play the game that would eventually speak for itself. So I loved his approach because he had everything kind of laid out in front of him with like what he needed to do to finally get to the end. And I did love that idea that his game would speak for itself, that he didn't want to have to sit at Final Tribal Council and explain his game. He just wanted to be like, well, you saw it, like, this is it. Yeah. And if this isn't enough, then I shouldn't win. And so he was very aware of what that jury would want his game to consist of. And he was able to pull it off by not trying to give them a resume, but just playing the players to create a resume for him.
Yeah. Now, along the way, as we saw, Tony adopted the lion and hyena strategy, which was great for him to push. And I think it was a lesson learned from Game Changers, where the lions all took each other out instead of working together. And, you know, then he saw the same thing happening at the beginning of the season. As he told Mike Bloom about the hyenas, they're just as dangerous as lions, but in a different way. Quote, these people are just going to stay on the sidelines and I'm going to duke it out with Sandra and Jeremy and they're going to come in and wipe us out.
Mm-hmm. I loved this gameplay that he created. But if I feel like it's almost, if we go back to Nick, when in his season that he won, where he was naming his alliances, you know, there's something to be said about giving people like a name for what's happening. And he kept referring to this, you know, the lions and the hyenas to really, I think, help other people divide in their minds who fit where. And it was helpful to him because he's not talking about alliances. You know, he's not talking about people that he's playing the game
alliances
with. Look at you. Instead, he's helping them recognize that there is a division and there are different people playing this game and there are people that fall into different categories. And by doing that, I think he was enabling them to play the game the way he wanted them to play it, because he was reminding them, listen, this person is a hyena over here. We need to watch out for them. You know, we're lions and we need to stay together. And it kind of emboldening those people who were playing with him, because you're building them up too. You're telling them you're a really great survivor player and you're someone that people recognize as a great survivor player. So we have to protect each other. These other people we need to watch out for. So you really are creating a narrative in other people's minds that helps them feel like they're elevated, but then also calls out those people that you need to be concerned with. So it was a really great strategy for sure.
Yeah. Now, another thing that he did was following through on what he told Entertainment Weekly in the preseason, and you already mentioned this, wanting to align himself with two different groups. A group that are close outside the game and a group of stragglers. And he'd tell both groups he's with them. Now, full disclosure, I thought this plan was a recipe for disaster because it assumed that nobody in those groups would talk to each other. But that'll teach me to question King Tony. You know, he knew what he was doing there and it worked.
It really did work. I mean, and this is what I think is so fascinating about Tony is that, and we can go back again to his Cagayan win, where it was like, wow, he pulled that off. And it's again one of those moments where I think we're all kind of sitting back going, wow, Tony pulled this off. But it was because he came into the season so prepared. He had thought about every possible way that the game could go and what he needed to do in order to fit into this potential theme and how best to fix his game from what he learned with Game Changers. I mean, he really did think about everything before he set foot on that beach. And you can tell by the way that his game played out. I mean, he definitely had everything covered and was not just kind of flying by the seat of his pants. He was very, very planned with everything he did. And he started from the moment he got out there.
Yeah. Now, one thing that Tony did that had me scratching my head a bit at the time was his flip against Sophie. It seemed like it was mostly because she was too close to Sarah, but Tony explained in interviews that it was much more than that. Indeed, he pegged it as his key move because otherwise he believed Sophie would have wiped the floor with everyone and I would have gotten the correct winner pick.
It was all about you, David. It was all about you.
He told Mike Bloom that it was the sucker punch once everyone had their guard down. And after that devastating blow, it threw everybody off balance. And then there was the flurry of punches that didn't stop. The punches just kept coming. It was supposed to be Jeremy, but he flipped it to Sophie. It was supposed to be Jeremy again, but he made it Kim by pulling two feuding members of his alliance together. He gained trust with Jeremy by saving him twice and telling him correctly not to use the 50-50 coin. That made Jeremy believe Tony was on his side, but then Jeremy was gone.
No, he did something that is very, very difficult in this game, and that flipping back and forth in the way that he did it. And we talked about it when it actually happened, when Sophie got voted out. The way that he pulled that move off was, it was incredibly smart because he waited until the absolute last moment to tell everybody. So it didn't give anybody a chance to scramble. It didn't give anybody a chance to try to go and tell someone that this is happening. And that is a sign of a really great Survivor player and someone who's very familiar with how the game works. And this is why a returning season is always interesting, because you've learned from the previous mistakes and you've learned from the game that you played before. So he knew that they had a very limited amount of time. He said, I was watching the sun. And I thought that that was really great that he thought about it so much that he knew, okay, now this is when I'm going to pull this off, to limit everyone else's ability to react to it. And then, yeah, like you said, he was then able to continue to flip back and forth, which is something that is very, very difficult to do because people start questioning your loyalty. But he did it in a way that was kind of almost based on loyalty that he had created with these people before. So he had some reserves so he could go back and explain to them, well, this is why I did this, because it was beneficial for both of us, and was really able to win them back very easily. You know, we didn't see anything drastic and any real pushback or blowback for Tony for doing this. He was able to justify it and really almost make it about that other person. Like, I did this for us, and this is why this is a great move for us. It's not for me, it's for both of us. When really it was more for just Tony.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, because of the moves like that, he was always on the right side of the vote until the Ben vote, which didn't really matter. You know, as Sophie said in her Jury Speaks video, Tony was always staying one step ahead of everyone else. Adam said in his own Jury Speaks that Tony seemed to have directed the vast majority of the post-merge votes and was in control for far more of this game than any other person. Amber, Kim, and Yule echoed those sentiments, while Sarah added that they had multiple alliances besides Cops R Us that we didn't even know about. And they were named. They had the justice system, the game changers, you know, and some she couldn't even remember. And it was all about who controlled the game.
And I do think that, I mean, we've got to give Sarah credit for what they were able to do, because they did do a lot of these things together. I mean, this was a group strategy, if you will, between the two of them, between Cops R Us, that were dominating the game strategically together. And, and that's really to her credit as well, because this was something that they came up with 6 years ago, 7 years ago now, you know, that like they wanted to just Cops R Us, and they were able to pull it off now. So I think it's really incredible to see that it took so long for them to finally like get here.
It was maturing on Ghost Island.
It really was. It absolutely was. But so, you know, we've got to give her credit too for pulling off this strategy, because she was the other half of it. Even though he pulled off the Sophie vote without her, But the fact that he was able to still bring her back into the fold and not wreck the relationship just speaks to how great he was at maintaining that relationship with her and really understanding what their dynamic was. And, you know, right. So I really got to give her credit too for coming up with this strategy.
Yeah. But I mean, Tony, and we will get to her, at least I will get to her. Tony had such a grip on the game that even when Natalie came back and told everyone how the jury felt he was definitely playing the best game, nothing really changed.
Oh, for sure.
She couldn't understand why, since she said that was the biggest piece of information she had when she returned, but it didn't work. Now, part of it could be basically what she told us before saying that, which is I could tell the truth, I could lie. So it wasn't even clear which it was. And similar to what you talked about earlier with the threat level, where she maybe was lying, maybe telling the truth about her relationships with the other people on Edge, it was the same thing here. If they didn't think that Tony was obviously the jury's choice, they could rationalize to themselves, oh, Natalie's just a troublemaker.
Well, you know, what I think is interesting about that is Natalie came in and said that, and that was the response that, oh, mm-hmm. We don't know if that's true. But Michelle is saying the same thing. And Michelle is playing the game with them. So there had to be some ability for the people who were playing with Tony to see that Tony is winning this, because Michelle is explaining it to those same people that Tony is winning. And then when Natalie comes back and she says the same thing, I feel like at that point you should probably take a step back and go, well, wait a second. Michelle told me that. Now Natalie's telling me, and Natalie's coming from the edge. So maybe we should actually consider that, because it could very well be the truth. So I don't know why there were such blinders on for the Tony is actually winning everyone over on the edge. I'm not sure why that happened. I think that was
because Tony.
Well, but that's incredible that, Tony was able to minimize, and we've talked already about his threat level mm-hmm. to these people, so much so that, he had Sarah convinced that if we sit together in the final, you'll beat me. I won't necessarily beat you, or we're going to split the votes. This is going to be cops or us until the end. And he really sold that narrative to her so much mm-hmm. to her detriment, for sure.
Yeah. Now, before we move on to the other players, I do have to note that one part of this rule talks about the use of sneakiness. And Tony had that pegged with the spy nest. I'm not sure that he actually ever found out anything useful that he wouldn't have known about anyway, since everything that we saw involved Sarah, his tight ally, talking to the person. So presumably she would have told him anyway. But it's possible there were other times we just didn't see, and also possible she might not have told him everything if he hadn't been literally hanging around up there. From now on, players are going to have to look behind every bush, up every tree, before they hatch a plan in the game.
And how about just don't do it at the water well? That could save you some time. Pick different spots to go and talk. Don't always go to the water well.
Yeah. So anyway, all right. After that very long discussion of Tony, I don't have a whole lot to say about Natalie, which makes sense since she was only around for the last few days. It might seem like she accomplished her goal of breaking up the main alliance, but that's really the only thing she could do. It was her and Michelle against the others, and she never actually was available to be voted out, like we mentioned. But she knocked off the people in about the order I would have expected them to go anyway. Denise was furthest from the core. Ben was next. She never accomplished the main task she needed, which was eliminating Tony. Compared to what we saw Chris Underwood do, she did not come back and take control. Although, to be fair, the jury told Chris exactly what he needed to do.
Yeah, but I don't know. I do feel like the order of the vote outs didn't make much sense. And the things that she could have done, why not just have Sarah and Denise go to fire? Like, why not? Like, why actually vote out Denise at that moment? Why not make them go to fire? I mean, it's not going to help you or hurt you in either way. I just feel like there was some missed opportunities. I also don't necessarily agree with the Ben vote. I don't know when we want to get there, but there's some components there that I feel like she could have definitely done or handled differently.
Yeah. Moving to Michelle, it's safe to say that if Tony was on the right side of almost all the votes, Michelle was the opposite for the post-merge game. But she never gave up and kept trying and knew what she had to do. She just couldn't get other people to do it with her. As she said at one point, everybody's playing scared, and later said getting people on board with a logical plan in this season is not as simple as it sounds. Mm-hmm. At one point outside the game, I heard she said it was frustrating because other players were too hesitant to make moves due to what they heard from Tyson about how terrible the edge was. Nobody wanted to make a move with her, which, yeah, I mean, like I just said, incredibly frustrating. She knew and she told others, there are some people you just can't beat. And it's one thing to get to the end. It's another to win it. She knew they couldn't beat Tony, like you just said, but nobody would do anything about it. As Ben said in his Jury Speaks video, Michelle never gave up trying to rally the troops. Unfortunately, she just couldn't muster the numbers.
Which is so unfortunate, because I do think that a lot of the complaints that people had about her from the jury in the Jury Speaks video was just that, that she was on the wrong side of the numbers, that she was kind of just floating around and wasn't able to really pull off anything. But it's not like she wasn't trying. I mean, the girl was attempting to, as you said, rally the troops. She was telling people Tony's going to win. She was really trying to get people to come up with other decisions and other potential votes, and getting frustrated when people were not going along with her suggestions and they were turning against her. And, you know, Jeremy and Nick and all of these people that she thought she had a close relationship with. I think in one of her exit interviews, she talked about how they were never really on the same page. And that is very unfortunate, because I don't know why they didn't all get on the same page. And maybe it was because, you know, Tony was, you know, shaking something shiny in the distance that caused them to be distracted. But it's too bad for her, because she was trying. And the fact that she's on the wrong side of the vote, yes, because she was being left out. But at the same time, she just couldn't pull a group of people together. In this season in particular, I think it's very interesting that nobody wanted to drop a name. You know, no one was willing to really say this needs to be the target. She was willing to do that. So I've got to give her credit for doing that.
Yeah. Now, clearly the jury felt like Michelle's game didn't deserve to win. But there is certainly merit to it. As Adam said in his Jury Speaks, Michelle epitomized the way the season was played, which was to get through the votes and make sure you didn't go home. And like you just said, nobody wanted to throw out names. He said Michelle laid back enough, but also pushed enough so she could be aware if her name came up, but wasn't pushing so hard that she became a target. She survived despite not really having strong alliances to keep her safe. She kept losing people, yet she found a way to survive. All of those things Adam said are true. But a game where she had to acknowledge that she was almost always on the outs was not going to win the season when Tony was there to show how he directed the whole thing.
And that, I think, is part of her problem, was that every time she sat in front of the jury, that's what she was expressing to them. You know, they not only were they hearing it from her, they were seeing it happen, too. And so a constant, you know, reminder every time Michelle would come back was that, yeah, I'm on the bottom again and I don't know what's going on. And in a group of winners, they're going to look at that as, well, that's not good gameplay, especially when you do have people over here that are controlling everything and that are, you know, making the vote go in the direction that they want. I mean, they weren't seeing that for Michelle. And unfortunately, they're limited to what they see at Tribal and then what they hear when people come to the edge. And so Michelle was not the driving force behind any of the votes. And that's not what they were seeing. It's not what they were hearing. But that's what they were seeing and hearing regarding Tony.
Yeah. Now, leaving the final three, we get to Sarah. It you already brought this up. It's difficult to say exactly what Sarah did specifically, because so much of it was done as part of her partnership with Tony. Certainly, she was in on every decision except Sophie. She almost always knew what was going on. You know, recall that she was the one who refused Tony's idol in the Kim vote because she knew where the votes were going. I think we would have gotten to see a lot more of what Sarah was doing if Tony had been the one who got knocked out in fire making, because I think she was the second best strategist out there this season.
Oh, for sure. I mean, she clearly knew what was happening. She had built very great relationships with people that allowed her to further both she and Tony's strategy. I think that they both had a different way of interacting with people. And, you know, Tony had one mechanism. She had a different mechanism. And she did say, she said in a lot of her interviews that one thing that she was constantly having to do was to keep Tony calm. And that was part of the job that she had, really, and part of their strategy, because he's up in the tree, but she's the one bringing people to the water well, you know what I mean? So it was, they really kind of balanced each other out very nicely, because I do think that at one point she even recognized this, that when she was making the clothes and wanted to do the fashion show, and she was trying to get Tony involved, and Tony was like, no, I'm not doing that. And he was leaving. And she acknowledged their different approach to the game and how, you know, she really has to be the more grounded of the two, because that was her, like, half of the duo, if you will. And so I think that they really did balance each other out. But unfortunately, yeah, we got to see more of Tony than Sarah, because, yeah, he ultimately is the one that won.
Right. Now, we did get to see a hint of how Sarah worked when she decided to make Ben think that he would have a turn driving. But really, she was just using Jedi mind tricks on him to push him in a specific direction while he thought it was his idea. You know, then at the very end, while we were wondering why Natalie and Michelle targeted Denise instead of Sarah, you were talking about this, we said we'd get to it. It was because Sarah made it seem like she was the one who was more likely to flip. Natalie told Gordon Holmes they asked Sarah if she would flip if they save her, and she said yes, and that Sarah, quote, definitely duped me.
Yes, and also there was some belief that she had an idol as well. That was part of her ploy in addition to...
Oh, yes. Yeah, the idol that Tony made her that she happened to be caught putting into her bag at exactly the right time. Yes.
So,
yeah,
so you got to... So, again, but that's utilizing a strategy to get them not to target her. And so it makes more sense now that we know that, because at the time it was kind of like, well, why are they all just voting for Denise? And why are they targeting Ben as opposed to targeting Sarah in this moment? Well, and that's exactly why, because they had had that discussion. We didn't see it. There was this potential idol that they thought she had. So again, they're not going to target her if she has an idol. So there was a lot that unfortunately we don't see that I think Sarah had a very big part in, because without, I mean, and she said it, without Tony or without Sarah, there's no Tony, you know, because they were really a dynamic duo through the whole game.
Yeah. Now moving to Ben, he came in wanting a Wendell and Dominic relationship. Instead, he aligned with a Wendell and Dominic relationship.
Yes.
You know, we discussed earlier how Ben told Gordon Holmes in the preseason that he thought others would see him as a threat, so he wanted to keep around the big threats to use as shields. And he did keep around these two threats, but he never got rid of them because they were his ride or die allies.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, because I think that Ben came into the season like, that was the thought that he had. He wanted to have an alliance, and that was his strategy coming in. I want to play this game with people. But it was almost like it blinded him so much, because it meant so much to him that he did have these people that he could fully trust and that were working with him, and that he felt like had his back, which he was missing in his first season. And so it was almost like it caused such a hindrance to the game that we wanted to see Ben play. Like, I wanted to see Ben running around like he did before and dropping those Ben bombs. And he didn't, because he was finding himself as part of this trio and group of people that were all voting together and playing the game together. And he felt like he had a solid alliance, that it really limited his ability to just strategize outside of it. You know, and we saw multiple times where he must have diarrhea of the mouth. You know, someone would talk to him and he couldn't maintain the information that he knew just for himself, because it was almost like he was so excited to be playing with people that he was like, okay, this is what's happening. And yes. All right, Boston Rob, let me tell you everything. And I think that really had a negative effect on his ability to strategize, is that he was just so excited to be playing the game with people who wanted to play with him, that he lost sight of needing to withhold information, needing to strategize a little bit differently, and really looking out for himself instead of other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, as for the rest of his game, he had some points we saw where he tried to make independent moves, but like you just said, they often didn't work so well. Another example is he told Jeremy to ask Michelle for her advantage and then warned Michelle that Jeremy was going to be asking her. But this little bit of trickery here relied on close allies, Michelle and Jeremy, not talking to each other, which was kind of a silly thing to assume. So that plan didn't work. Mm-hmm. It seems like most of his strategy that did work was directed by Tony and Sarah.
Yes, for sure.
Now, we know Denise had some good strategic moments earlier in the game since she was the Queen Slayer. And, you know, she played that damn well. She also created earlier allies and knew when she needed to cut them, such as Adam and Jeremy. But by her own admission, she didn't do enough of that. She responded in her social media Q&A that she needed to be much more active with strategy and trying to form alliances from day one, which, of course, this rule advises. She said, not having an alliance is not a good strategy. You need them. She tried for a solid alliance, but there was just too much chaos. Also, she said she was a bit too passive at tribal councils, which were obviously pretty active this season.
Yes, and she also acknowledged the fact that this game just moved a lot faster than she was really accustomed to. And, you know, she's someone who is a very loyal individual, and we saw that with her previous season. And, you know, this is a game with so many shifting alliances and people, you know, all of a sudden targeting this person. And I thought that she was going to do well with this, too, because she was willing to cut ties with people. And she said it, you know, that an alliance I have now might not be an alliance that I have on day 39. And, you know, she recognized that, like, it's time to cut my losses with Adam. It's time to cut my losses with Jeremy. But I think because she was willing to do that, she was losing sight of, but I might need to also be strategizing with these people and not just willing to cut them so easily, because I might need them down the road. And I do think that when that whole issue exploded at Tribal Council, when she kind of shut Jeremy down and Jeremy said to her, well, but you realize you have to be here tomorrow, right? Like, and it was, and I think he was just trying to get her to understand that you might need me. Like, I might need you. Like, don't cut mm-hmm. me off here, because we're probably going to need each other later. And I feel like sometimes she was losing sight of that. And it was almost like the Ben response to, I'm part of a group and this is the group I'm part of. And she's a very loyal person. And in this type of season, even though we saw that it worked for Tony and Sarah being loyal, it didn't necessarily work for her, because she was being loyal to Tony and Sarah, you know, so it all comes back to that.
Yeah. Now we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors and we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're back, so let's get back to the show. All right, well, we can finally move on to the second rule, and I can pretty well guarantee that no other rule will take as long as the first rule did. Now, the second rule says not to scheme and plot too much, to keep your scheming secret, and not to backstab too soon. Within this rule, I singled out Kagiyan Tony as an exception and noted that it's still not entirely clear to me how he managed to make it through. There were certainly times when I felt he backstabbed too soon or made us unnecessary moves, but no matter how he did it, future contestants should not count on being able to duplicate it. Now, it may be true that future contestants probably can't duplicate it, but Tony himself could. And I think we learned more about how he managed to do it last time by watching him this time. As Kim said in her Jury Speaks video, Tony voted her out and lied to her, but she always knew it was coming, so she didn't feel bad. Everyone knew Tony was a schemer, so it didn't surprise them that he schemed.
Yes, it actually worked towards his benefit, or, you know, that people expected this of Tony. And that's why I feel like his presentation of himself defying their expectations helped him in this regard even more. Because it was like when he finally did do a Tony thing, they were like, oh, well, that makes sense because that's Tony. Whereas when Tony mm-hmm. wasn't acting like Tony, they were confused and it threw them off. And so it worked so well for him that when he lived up to those Tony expectations, everyone was kind of okay with it because that's what they were expecting all along. So I really find that fascinating. It really is like a big Jedi mind trick that he was able to pull off the entire time he was out there. It really was.
Yeah. Now, Tony and Sarah even managed to survive doing one of the things this rule specifically warns against. You know, he even told Mike Bloom, the theme of the season is that everybody wants to break up the power couples. You see Natalie go first because of Jeremy. You see Amber go second because of Rob. We needed to stay away from each other. We'd just meet in the bushes saying we were going to pee in two different places. And then they'd meet up and bounce ideas off each other. And he said they did. And they did a great job hiding it. And nobody even mentioned breaking them up until later in the game.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an amazing feat on any season, but especially on a returning player season where everybody knows that they know each other.
Right. And I think that their prior gameplay together probably helped them here too, because we saw it happen in Cagayan where there was supposed to be Cops R Us and Tony stabbed her in the back and got rid of Sarah. So I don't think anyone expected her to have Tony's back because she was so angry with him about what happened there. Then when we get to Game Changers, they never even got to play together. So nobody saw their relationship mend. You know, there wasn't a chance to see that the Tony and Sarah actually play the game together like there was watching Amber and Rob play the game together, like there was watching Natalie and Jeremy play the game together. Nobody saw that. They tried it. He didn't care about it. And he cut her very early first season. So it was an interesting way to handle it now because no one was really in their mind remembering a strong Sarah Tony duo before. So they might have just thought, well, you know what? They don't like each other because of what happened previously and they've never buried the hatchet. But Sarah talked about the fact that, yeah, no, we buried the hatchet. We talked and we were ready to move forward. But they were mindful of the fact that people might see them playing the game together. So they kept their distance as long as they needed to.
Yeah, I think it helps that neither of them has been terribly active in the Survivor community. Mm. And so because of that, like, I didn't know that they were super tight friends you know, the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. And you know, so if the Survivor community didn't know this, probably the Survivor players didn't know this either.
Right. No, it's a much different dynamic when you've got people coming in who everyone knows on social media is hanging out. People are playing mm-hmm. poker games together. They're going on trips together. You know, I mean, all of these things that people see. And that was a relationship that you just never saw because they didn't make it something that the whole world knew about. And I do think that it definitely worked for their benefit, for sure.
Yeah. Now, you know, as far as some of the other people, you know, Natalie didn't have time to scheme and plot too much. So you didn't have to worry about that. Michelle and Denise seemingly didn't do it enough. So we can certainly say they didn't have a problem here either. Ben, however, got a reputation for turning on his allies. Michelle told Gordon Holmes that she, Adam, and others felt they were very solid with Ben, but then he started alienating people for basically no reason that they could see. He turned on Rob, Adam, Jeremy, Michelle herself, and none of them could figure out why he was doing that. My best guess is because he found new allies in Sarah and Tony, but it's still not great to turn on people who thought they were solid with you.
Well, and I think that this goes back to his struggle with actually playing this game with an alliance. You know, mm-hmm. it's something that he didn't do very well his first season and really had to fight in order to get to the final three and to win. People respected the gameplay because of the Ben bombs and the big moves that he was making. And so I think now we have a Ben who's trying to live in a new world of Survivor and play in this game where he has alliance people and he's got, you know, a group of individuals that want to play the game with him that he feels he can trust. So I think by doing that, he ended up alienating himself from the people that weren't part of that alliance, because it's a hard thing to have a core group and still include the other people who are not part of that group and make them feel like they're included while keeping eyes on the prize, you know, with my alliance. Like, these are the people that really matter, but then these people over here, I need to keep happy as well. Tony did that very well. Tony knew that I need to talk to everybody and I need to keep everybody in check. I feel like Ben just kind of discounted people and thought, oh, you know what? They're not part of my core alliance, so I'm not going to focus on them as much.
Yeah. All right, we can move to the third rule, which talks about being flexible. And we have to once again talk about how Tony came into the game this time compared to his previous two. Wendell, Nick, Denise, Ewell all mentioned in their Jury Speaks videos how he changed his game and adapted his play. Nick noted this showed versatility as a Survivor player. Ewell called it impressive how Tony changed his approach.
Yeah, I mean, he did everything he had to in order to get over the hurdles of being Tony playing in an all-winner season. And everybody saw his game play and everybody knew what to expect. He completely changed every component of that game. So 100% he came into this game adapting to everything he needed to adapt to, including himself, really. You know, I mean, he was changing up Tony in order to play a better game. And so I can't say enough about his willingness to change everything about himself in order to pull off this win.
Yeah. Now, Michelle showed a great deal of flexibility as well, sometimes needing to have even more because she didn't have a Title Alliance to rely upon. But even before the merge, she showed she was willing to be flexible when she told Nick that if he felt strongly about voting out either Ewell or Wendell, she would follow him. This goes along with what she said in the preseason about planning to go in playing completely flexible, and it got her all the way to the final three.
Yes, I mean, she had to be flexible because she was playing from the bottom. And when you don't have a core group of people who you're solid with, who you're voting with, you have to have the willingness to jump ship and go back and forth and vote with this group and then vote with that group and really kind of look at what your options are, because that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah. Now, once again, I don't really have anything to say for Natalie because there wasn't time for flexibility on her part. She came back and had to survive, period.
And she needed to find the person that she could try to survive with, and she knew that person would be Michelle.
Yeah. Now, Sarah played with some of the same flexibility as Tony did, but really nobody can quite match him there. And there were times when we saw them arguing where Tony seemed to have good reasons for wanting to change things while Sarah wanted to do things the way she had planned. But I think in almost all those cases, she eventually went along with him anyway.
Yeah, except the she's got an idol and no, she doesn't conversation.
Well, yes, yes.
that's a big one right there where she was pretty locked in on that. But I do think for the most part, she was willing to kind of ebb and flow with what the game needed to do. But it was also in order for her and Tony to make it to the final three. So she was flexible in how they were going to get there, but they still had a pretty good, you know, read on the situation and how the game was going down. So their need to be flexible wasn't as much as Michelle's need, because they were really controlling things. So their ability to be flexible when you're leading the charge is much easier because you're the one calling the shots.
Yeah. Now, Ben, however, could definitely be inflexible and difficult to wrangle. It seemed like Tony had to expend a lot of energy making sure Ben was going with the alliance plan, because Ben would just get focused on somebody and, you know, get tunnel vision like he did with wanting Jeremy out. I mean, there were times when Ben wouldn't even talk to Jeremy, but everybody knows you have to at least pretend to consider what other people have to say.
Yeah. And he did the same kind of thing to Adam when they were arguing oddly about the idol and I don't know, peanut butter and jelly or something. That got weird. And I do think that this was a problem for Ben, that he really did kind of have tunnel vision of Jeremy. He really could not get over the issue he had with Jeremy. And I think sometimes you really just need to kind of set that aside. I mean, I know he said in his exit interview why that happened, that he just felt like he couldn't trust Jeremy because of an early conversation they had.
Right.
But sometimes you just have to kind of look at the game, and especially if your thought process is all of the big threats need to stay together. Jeremy is someone that you don't want to turn your back on. You want to be able to have a conversation with. And he really did shut Jeremy down, even though Jeremy was trying to rebuild a relationship with Ben. So it wasn't like that was Jeremy doing it to Ben. It was Ben doing it to Jeremy. So unfortunately, that didn't benefit Ben at all.
Yeah. Didn't benefit him. Now, I don't really have much for Denise here, because there were so many times when we really just didn't see her thought process. Do you have anything to add for her?
You know, you're really not giving Denise enough love. She was my winner pick.
I know, but we didn't see her is the problem. And I'd love to give her that, but we just didn't see much of her. So it's hard to say. That's why I'm asking you. Go ahead.
No, I think that, I mean, I think Denise, it's a very similar thing that we saw with Ben again, you know, where it's like you are part of a group and she, it's kind of groupthink. And I think we saw a lot of groupthink that started with that alliance. And unfortunately, that groupthink wasn't to her benefit. It wasn't to Ben's benefit, but she was willing to go with the groupthink. And so I feel like she struggled just kind of like Ben did.
All right. Well, we can move to the fourth rule, which tells players not to let their emotions control them. And once again, Tony comes out on top here. I don't think there has ever been a case where Tony voted emotionally instead of strategically. That's a little tongue twister there. And I believe a key lies in how he views Survivor, which is as a game.
Mm-hmm.
We saw this come up a couple times in the debate between Tony and Jeremy about whether 9 days was 2 weeks. Jeremy talked about it being work. And Tony argued, no, it's a game. And when Ben found the idol and tried to hide it, Tony said, hey, I thought we were good. And Ben replied, well, look at what you did to me last vote, you know, when I wasn't in on it. Tony said, we're past that. It's over. And Ben's like, that was like 4 hours ago. And that's exactly it. To Tony, that was a game move in the past. Doesn't matter if it was just a few minutes ago. It's gone. It's behind us. As he told Gordon Holmes, when did you ever see him mad? How can he be mad when he's playing a game? And then he added to Mike Bloom that a lot of people can't separate the emotional element from the game, but he has no problem doing that because it's just a game.
Yes. And I think he even said this in one of the episodes where he, in a confessional, reminded himself and the viewers that he can't go into this emotionally. He has to go pedal to the metal, like, I got to play this game. And so he was even recognizing that it can't be an emotional call. It has to be about game moves and what's going to benefit his game. So he was very mindful of that, even though he had tight relationships with people and even though he really liked people. I think this is why he was able to not have hate from the jury, because he was recognizing this is a game, and that even though, you know, we're creating this relationship, it doesn't mean that it's not real. I have to get to the end. And you were in my way. You know, you were someone who I needed to vote out because you were a threat to my game. And he reminded them of that in his final, you know, jury answer, if you will. Like, Nick, you were going to vote me out, so I needed to take you out. Jeremy, you were a threat to my game. And so I think there's a respect for that, because he is turning it into what exactly it is. And this is a game. You're trying to win. And I think it's great that he was able to separate the two out so nicely.
Yeah. And as part of it just being a game, he told Mike Bloom that people just believe in me because I was real at the moment I'm talking to them. You know, make it, that wine go through your nose.
That was a bad time to take a drink.
Yeah. He said, my feelings are real. So people have to believe me because it's so genuine while I'm talking to them. But 10 minutes later, if I'm back into game mode, I don't care what I just did to you. If you have to go, you have to go.
Yeah. Again, this is something that I do think people struggle with playing Survivor. I mean, for someone who's been out there, it's very trying. And when you have to vote out someone you consider a friend, it is definitely painful. And I think in this particular season, when you do have the edge of extinction, there's an additional layer to that. Because you're voting people out, and at the beginning of the game, you're never seeing these people again. But in this particular season, when the edge of extinction is a component of it, all of those people are potentially coming back, and you're going to see all of them again sitting there on the jury. And to have a group of people still respect you, even though you voted them out, because you're showing respect for the game, is very impressive.
Yeah. And I also want to, you know, make it clear, it's not to say Tony has no feelings, because Ben said in his Jury Speaks video that it emotionally hurt Tony to vote out people he got close with. Tony cried a lot this season and didn't like to hurt people. And you know, yes, it is fine to have emotions. Like you said, you're going to have them. But as Tony said when voting out Jeremy, I have to put my emotions aside and play the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, you know, we move on here. And once again, I don't have much to say about Natalie. I don't know what her emotions may have been telling her regarding the people she was voting out, but it wasn't like she had much choice. As far as I know, none of these people were her friends, and she certainly didn't have time to get to know them very well.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I do think that, well, it's interesting because she obviously was coming at this from a different perspective. I mean, her emotional connection and attachments were to people on the edge, not to people in the game, because right. she didn't play with these people in the game very long. And so it's a different type of response that you're seeing from Natalie, because she's mindful of the people who she's been sitting, you know, on the edge with, and she knows what they're saying about the other people who she's playing the game with now. So it's a hard thing to compare, because she is very aware of where they're coming from. And, you know, the fact that this person might not like that person, or that person might not vote for this person because they've got an issue with them, and that there will be an emotional response from the jury because she's been hanging out with them. So she's coming mm-hmm. at it from a much different perspective than anybody else who was in the game the whole time.
Yeah. Now, Michelle didn't have much opportunity for this to be a problem due to all the reasons we've already mentioned, but it did come up at the Yule vote, after which point Michelle tweeted, "I only have love and respect for Yule, but he is smart and connected. Nick and I made the decision together based on what we thought would be best for us at the merge. Strategy-wise and without emotion, we felt it made the most sense to stick with Wendell." So when it came down to it, she made the right decision without emotion.
Yes. And I think that we even saw this with her relationship with Wendell, because that was a resonating theme that we kept seeing, that they knew each other. They were kicking it at some point. Yeah. So, you know, but she was able to also separate that out as well. She utilized it. I think that, you know, she had that prior relationship with him, and she also didn't get mad at Nick when Nick turned his back on her and voted differently than she expected him to. And she, again, could have gotten angry at Nick, but she knew that she was still going to need Nick, and so she set that aside. So she was at least trying to take emotion out of it and really try to play the game as much as she could with the people that she was playing the game with. So I do think that she did this very well, too.
Yeah. Now, Sarah did it throughout the game as well, which was also something she did in Game Changers that got her the win. As she told Mike Bloom, her social game was 100% real. But when it was time to write somebody's name down, she'd write your name down. The name of the game is to write someone's name down. And she's exactly right. You know, as Tony told Mike, the first time Sarah played, she couldn't separate the emotional element from the game, which was why he swore on the badge and was able to get away with that. Mm-hmm. She learned after that, and I would say it made her a much better player.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because it's something that she clearly struggled with, because when she came back in Game Changers and was able to play, people thought she was very robotic and didn't think that she really was mindful of people's feelings. And that was why she got a lot of angry jury people, you know, like during the finale in that season, there was a lot of, I don't know, people were just upset with her because...
Well, they were upset with her actually because they thought, because she was doing this too well.
Yes.
She was making the relationships with them and then voting them out anyway.
Right. But I think that that's something that she yeah. struggled with, because she saw right. so much backlash for that, that she was able to cut people that she was supposed to have a relationship with, that I think she was more mindful of it this season in trying to manage it a little bit better. Like that I'm going to have relationships with people, but it is still a game. But I think she did a better job this time of making people feel like it's a game move and it's not personal. Whereas I think mm-hmm. in Game Changers, people took it personal.
Yes, definitely. Now, as we move to Ben, there were definitely times where he let his emotions get in the way of his game. But before we get to those, there's one decision Ben made that has caused quite a lot of debate, and we need to talk about it. Before we do so, I want to remind everyone about the final few sentences in the opening paragraph of the rules. And I know everyone listening and watching has already read this, but I'm just going to, you know, reread it for you. It says, "The other presumption here, and I know it sounds silly, but it needs to be said, is that the player actually wants to win. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be there for the experience mm-hmm. or to face the toughest opponent or whatnot. Survivor is a game, and the goal is to win. Period. That is the basic assumption here, and these rules can lead good players to that end goal. To quote Harry, a super fan on the most recent season of Australian Survivor, people should play to win.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure what Ben's full intent was upon coming into the game. By the finale, his goal was clearly not to win, because he let his emotions rule him as he told Sarah it was okay to vote him out.
Yeah. Yeah. I disagree with this move for so many reasons. I mean, obviously it's not an I'm going to win move. I mean, we heard a lot about his reasoning for it. He recognized that he wasn't going to win if he went to a final three with Tony and Sarah. And so he knew how the jury was perceiving him. I guess Natalie was really drilling it into his brain that nobody mm-hmm. liked him. He had even been mindful of the fact that no one was giving him tokens. And, you know, and he saw how the jury was responding to him. And he saw how Natalie responded to him. So he, in his own mind, had already decided, okay, I'm not winning this game. I'm losing this game. But at that moment, with that clarity, there is something he could have done so much differently. And he could have saved both himself and Sarah and gotten rid of Tony at the same time if he had played this differently. This is just my opinion on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where if he had stayed in the game and had, you know, let her vote for Michelle like they were going to do, he could have been then in the final four. And regardless of who wins, you know, that if it's still Natalie that wins at final four, who are you sending to make fire against Tony at that point? You're sending Ben, because Ben is the mm-hmm. one that everyone's been talking about. I don't want to go up against Ben making fire. But if there's this idea in everybody's head that Ben is not going to win, if Natalie has been told Ben's not winning because the jury doesn't think he's going to win, if Sarah knows that the jury doesn't think Ben is going to win, there's no benefit to voting out Ben. You want to bring Ben with you because you want Ben to be sitting there if there's this idea that he's not going to win. So why not utilize Ben to your benefit? Keep him there, vote out Michelle, have him go against Tony and fire. And then guess who's sitting in the final three? It's Sarah, Ben, and Natalie. I don't understand how he thought he was helping her game by saying, this is your game move, because her voting out Ben doesn't mean anything because the jury is looking at Ben as a non-element, if you will. Like, he's not going to win. So voting him out is not a big game move. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple things that didn't make sense. One, he said he wanted to leave the game with a true friendship. And two, the part that you said. So the first part, well, it's not like he would have lost Sarah as a friend if he hadn't given her permission to vote right. him out. I mean, Ponderosa video showed us he already had two other very good friendships from the season in Denise and Sophie. Mm-hmm. As far as giving Sarah the big move for the jurors, we saw in the Jury Speaks videos that they were crediting Natalie and Michelle with that anyway, which was something that most of us watching suspected would happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, it you know, from that standpoint, it didn't make sense. And like you said, okay, he was thinking he couldn't have won the game anyway. Fine. But on this podcast, we viewed the game through the lens of winning and doing whatever you can to make that happen. Giving someone permission to vote you out when it's not necessary goes completely against mm-hmm. that. Could he have won at final three? Almost certainly not. Should he have tried? Yes. And, you know, not to mention, there's extra money that comes with a better placement.
Right. But also, you could be in front of a jury. If he had gone against Tony and fire and taken Tony out, he's sitting right. in front of the jury going, I took out Tony. I took the guy out of the game that was going to win. And it could have changed his whole narrative. It could have changed the whole story that the jury is going to see and how they're going to perceive things. And if they're perceiving that Sarah and Tony were doing everything together, are they going to give Sarah all the credit for Tony's moves? Maybe, maybe not. You know, maybe they would have looked at Ben and said, hey, Ben took that guy out and still credited Tony with all those moves, because Ben could have said Sarah was just doing everything Tony wanted to do. So there was so many things he could have done here. And I respect him greatly for wanting to come out of this game feeling differently and feeling good about himself and knowing that he has friends for life. And I totally respect that 100%. But it's also, he could have still had both. he could have still fought and tried to be in front of a jury in a final three and win.
Yeah, and it's just not how he was thinking. And I think he would admit he was thinking emotionally. You know, he in interviews, he talked about the things that we've just gone over and about also how he was going to get crucified by the old schoolers who didn't understand his game. And he said in an interview, I didn't want to come home knowing I had gotten dragged across the coals, wondering what they would show on TV. He discussed the emotional drain of making it to Final Three and not knowing for almost a year whether or not he'd won, even if he was pretty sure he'd lost. All of these were emotional reasons. And I'm not saying it's bad to have emotions. I'm saying in this game, you need to do whatever you can to put those aside.
Yes. And I think that in that moment, his thought that he was going to be helping Sarah and saving her really just caused her to lose and be out of the game. I mean, that's really, that's what I see. I see that this idea of them going to the end together was something that he could have used to his benefit to take out Tony. I mean, he and Sarah were talking about taking out Tony at five and Tony won immunity. So they couldn't do that. So it's not like they were unaware and they had all this information from the edge where Tony's going to win. Tony's going to be credited with all of these things. So, okay, let's figure out how to make this work. Sarah, you and I are now going to take over and we're going to play this game together instead of just kind of throwing in the towel and thinking that somehow this is going to be Sarah's big move and she's voting out Ben, who the jury doesn't even think is going to win.
Right. I mean, I do think one thing that played in Ben's mind is related to something else he told Mike Bloom, where he said, as long as one of Tony, Sarah, or myself sat at the end, it's a win for me and my game. Well, I sit here saying, no, it's not a win for you or your game because you didn't win.
Yeah.
Tony.
Yeah.
Tony got the $2 million check. It's not shared.
Mm-hmm.
I just suspect a lot of that thought process is still with him from the military, where it's drummed into you. It's not about you as an individual, but everybody together as a single unit. If your unit takes that hill, then you win the battle.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not the same on Survivor.
No, and I think that that's probably very fair because obviously you can't take who you are as a person and just completely set that person aside. And I think that Ben struggled a lot with his season that he won, which we've talked about. And I think that this was part of that struggle is that he found himself wanting to play so badly with a group of people that it was just blinding him to every other possibility. And the fact that he could have played a very similar game to what he played in his previous season, but chose not to because he had a group that he was playing with, as opposed to I can play with a group and I can still own it and I can still have Ben bombs and I can still do these big moves that will be respected. Instead, he just lost sight of it because of the emotional toll that it took on him. I think from winning his season the way that he did, that really came into this season with him very heavy. I think that was a very big weight for him. We talked a lot about Michelle coming into the game, feeling like she had something to prove. You know, I think Ben came into this game feeling like he needed to prove that he can play with other people and have their back and they can have his, as opposed to feeling like he has to fight every single day to stay and fight every single day to win. He wanted to be able to kind of get there with other people. And it didn't work for him, unfortunately.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned that there were some other times when Ben let his emotions get in the way, so we can move on to those now. We talked earlier about how he was turning on his previous allies, and I think a good part of that came from an emotional reaction. We also discussed how badly he wanted Jeremy gone and wouldn't even talk to him. We at least finally got some explanation as to what happened. Now, you talked about this a little bit. I want to give the detail here because Ben told interviewers that he approached Jeremy on day one and said they should work together. As he was walking away, Jeremy made a motion to the camera like, look at this clown. And Ben caught him. You know, so after that, he pretended to work with Jeremy, but never trusted him fully. And while that reaction is understandable, that's a long time in this game to hold a grudge. And he still shouldn't have allowed himself to show it outwardly.
Yes. And that's something, it's always good to have that information when you're playing this game. You're like, you know that that's what Jeremy did. So you can kind of put that in the back of your mind. But it's not like you need to that's be all and end all, you know, that like, I'm never going to speak to this guy again and I don't want to play this game with him. It was just it's kind of a little thing, you know, I mean, like, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, okay, that was a reaction he had, but that was very, very early on in the game, very early on in the game. And it's one of those moments where you just have to kind of look at the big picture and say, well, how much is this going to actually affect my game moving forward? And if your strategy is coming into this game wanting to have the big threats bond together, then you've got to just work with Jeremy. You have to figure out how to make it work, especially when Jeremy is trying to make it work. I mean, after that, Jeremy got to a point where he was coming to Ben and wanting to talk to Ben and wanting to work with Ben, and Ben was just shutting him down. So I really feel like this is one of those moments that he could have utilized it much better. It was information he had and he could have used it. And instead he let it kind of take control of that relationship.
Yeah. And then another time his emotions interfered was at the vote when Natalie returned, as Tony insisted she likely had an idol and they should split the votes. Ben acknowledged that a smart Survivor player would do that, but he refused because he didn't want to risk putting votes on his friend Denise. And it's just another instance of the same mistake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he was looking at friendship over gameplay.
Right. I feel a little bad after talking about Ben for all of this, because I probably liked him even more this season than the first season.
He was great.
Yeah, but, well, we have to follow this rule, too, so we could properly analyze how Ben acted.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the unfortunate part, I think, when you do have someone who's played the game once, because you do learn. I mean, I know if I were to ever play again, there's a lot of things that I learned about what I should and shouldn't do on the island. And I think Ben has had that time to reflect on his previous game. And I think, you know, Tony did the same. And Tony learned from his mistakes and flipped the script entirely and was able to work on his game and improve it immensely. I think Ben tried to do the same thing, but his focus was not on the game anymore. It was about relationships, and it was about a desire to come out of this, having those personal relationships and having friendships for life. And I think you can still have that, but play a hell of a game like we saw Tony do.
Yeah. Okay, as we move on to Denise, she didn't have the same problem as Ben. We already talked about how she cut both Adam and Jeremy when she needed to, despite being friends and allies with both of them. I don't know if she would have cut her closer friend Ben if it came to it, but I think she would have.
Oh, I think she would have too. I mean, we saw her do this to Malcolm in the season that she won. I mean, that was
true.
That was a very difficult decision for her, but she also knew she couldn't go to the end with Malcolm because she was going to lose. So I think that she's someone who's very kind of linear. And yes, those relationships are important to her, but she also knows this is time to cut them. And I do think that even though she was, as I said, kind of in that groupthink and really working with the alliance, she was at least still very aware of those outliers, because Jeremy wasn't part of that core alliance. Adam was not part of that core alliance. So anybody that she had on the side, she was willing to kind of toss to the side. And I do think that if she needed to, she would have cut Ben. But I think it would have been a harder sell than getting Sarah to do it.
Right. All right, we can move to the fifth rule, which is all about the social game and reminds players they need to pretend to be nice. While Tony might not have known, might not have been known for his social game because it's not as flashy as his other moves, it was arguably his social game that allowed him to make those flashy moves. Mm-hmm. As Sarah said in her Jury Speaks video, a lot of people didn't expect him to be so personal. He's funny, caring, and people enjoy him. Nick added that Tony was very good at building relationships, while Wendell said Tony let people know about his family and showed his funny side. Tony himself said in his social media Q&A that he had a lot of heart-to-heart talks about personal lives. All of this led to a situation described by Parvati in her Jury Speaks video, that Tony blindsided people without them being bitter, and everybody said they weren't resentful. That is, I mean, that's truly social game mastery.
Yes. And it was interesting that Boston Rob was the one that inquired of Tony about this at that final tribal council. Like, basically, how did you do that? Like, we're fascinated because Boston Rob was someone who had an incredibly bitter jury. Right? Yeah. I mean, they hated him so much so that they, you know, even Amber acknowledged it, that they, they ended up hating me a little bit less than they hated him. So I think for someone like Boston Rob to recognize that, like, how did you pull that off? And that you have people who were on that jury that were unable to ever do that, and they still won. That is a huge compliment to Tony, that he was able to still make people feel good and feel good about the relationship, even as he was writing their name down and sending them down that path. So it's a masterful thing to pull off. And the fact that he was able to do it so incredibly well, I just speak, it speaks volumes of how wonderful his social gameplay was.
Yeah. Now, Natalie didn't have time to do the same thing in the main game, but she tried to do it on the edge. In her social media Q&A, Natalie said she made relationships on the edge that she hoped would turn into votes. Of course, this is one big reason we hate the edge, because it gives the opportunity for a player to become friends with the jurors. But in this case, I also think Natalie overestimated how much those relationships would come into play in the voting. Still, it was the best shot she had, and she went for it.
And if you look at the people that voted for her, I think it's a testament to the fact that they were really voting for a friend. Kind of, I mean, you, Jeremy and Tyson are two very good examples of people that she had a very strong bond with and a relationship with outside of the game. And also in, I mean, she played with Jeremy before. And so I do think that it is a testament to those relationships. And she was shocked that Danny didn't vote for her, which again, I think just shows you how much emphasis was being placed on the relationship she was forming on the edge. And even Boston Rob asked her about this in their final tribal council as well. Why did you kind of disconnect yourself from the group that last week on the edge? And he was almost insulted by that, that she was keeping herself separate and apart from them. So I really do see this as a huge problem, you know, that like that you are trying to develop relationships and that you're actually being called out by people on the jury going, why'd you cut me out when we were out there together struggling and suffering, you know, through this. And to me, yeah, I mean, that's what she had to do, was try to play up those relationships.
Right.
But at the same time, yeah, I mean, it's unfair for the people that, like, Tony never even met some of these people, you know, and she spent 35
literally,
days.
Yeah.
With them, so.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, you know, Natalie admitted, yeah, Rob's not wrong. I definitely kind of withdrew from the collective of Extinction.
Mm-hmm.
She had explanations, you know, noting that early on she was doing everything for everybody, but then there were too many people and almost everybody on the edge got into what she called zombie mode, you know, walking around the beach. She said she needed to be in the right headspace to win the return challenge and thought everybody else would understand that. Obviously they didn't. And for at least some of them, it seems like she lost the biggest advantage she had in hanging out with the jury for all that time. Like you just said, I think that they were all in kind of kumbaya mode. We're all out here struggling together.
Yeah.
And she was with that until it, you know, got to a certain point. And then she was like, I'm going to kick all your asses.
Yeah. Which I think is interesting. And this is one of the concerns I had with the edge of Extinction as the season kept developing. I mean, I came into this season saying, I can't imagine, and I believe you said the same, that a group of seasoned winners would ever vote for someone who was on the edge because they have a respect for the game and outwit, outplay, outlast. And that's what we believe these players will be doing on a season like this. But I do think that the struggle on edge that they were all suffering through together kind of took hold, and they were really developing this kind of bond that nobody can understand except them, because they were getting, you know, a teaspoon of rice a day or something ridiculous, and or a tablespoon. It was a very, very small amount of rice that they were eating.
One grain of rice. One grain.
It was very small. But yeah, and then they were struggling through these weird challenges together. And so I do think that that mentally was kind of taking hold of, we all struggled together. We all got through this together. And I think that Natalie really did think that that would give her votes, because there was a bonding there that Tony never got to have. And, you know, and Michelle never got to have. And all of these people that were still in the game never actually experienced. So I do think that it's an interesting thing to have watched develop as the season went on, that there's a possibility here that an all winners season could actually vote for someone from the edge to win because of that mental strain that they all shared together.
Yeah. I mean, it's what happened the first season mm-hmm. of EOE.
Yeah.
So, all right, moving to Michelle. I don't think there's anyone who doubts that she is very social and likable. Multiple jurors commented on it in their videos. Jeremy added that she could mask the fact that she doesn't like you and just talk to you, and you won't even know she despises you. In other words, she pretends to be nice. Michelle herself said on her social media Q&A that the key to her success was that she was able to remain optimistic and not get too frustrated despite being left out of the vote. It's hard not to flip out, but she knew that it would hurt her game because the people who betrayed her today may need to betray someone else tomorrow.
And also she was getting fire tokens from like everybody. So I think that that also shows that she was at least likable because, you know, when they're leaving the game and they have to bequeath their tokens to someone, they're certainly not going to be leaving them to someone that they despise or someone that they're not interested in, mm-hmm. you know, potentially going further or playing the game. And she was able to accumulate the most fire tokens. And she did talk in her exit press how she was hoping that that would turn into jury votes because it showed that people liked her. Unfortunately, that didn't carry over.
Yeah, not so much.
Not so much. But her social game is what she's so very good at. And that's what she was great in the season she won. And that's what she was showing here as well. She's someone who you just enjoy talking to. And I think that unfortunately for her, that didn't carry into the strategic component as much as it did for someone like Tony and Sarah, who were able to mesh them together so much better because they were in control of the game.
Right. Now, going on to Sarah, I noted in our preview podcast that in Game Changer, she played a social game that allowed her to get to know people on a personal level and still double cross them. And we heard from a number of jurors about how much that hurt. And that's what we were talking about earlier. But as she told Mike Bloom, anybody who's played with her would say she's one of the most genuine people you'll ever meet. She added that her social game is not fake. It's 100% real. And that's why it works so well. I agree. And I think she definitely showed it again here when she came in as perhaps the player most people told Dalton Ross they wanted to vote out mm-hmm. first. And yet she made it to the final four.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because one of the things she also said was about Sophie and how she thought that she and Sophie would end up being like mm-hmm. best friends. And she completely called it correctly. And so I think she is very aware of herself and the way that she presents herself to people. And she really has a great way to connect. And this is something that I talked about previously with she and Tony being kind of different about the way that they would connect with people. Even though he had a great social game, I think she was connecting with people in a different way than Tony was. I mean, Tony was finding something that they had in common and was able to talk to people. I think it was a little more genuine for Sarah because Tony was doing it more for game reasons. Sarah was doing it for game reasons, but she's also just very good at being personable. And so I do think that, her social game really shone through. And I think she did a much better balance this time of being that Sarah Lucina that we saw in Game Changers, that people were like shocked that she was able to cut people the way that she did, still doing the same thing here, but it was more respectful because she was able to kind of separate the two.
Yeah. Now, compare or contrast that to Ben, who did not have a great social game his first win. He said in pregame interviews that he wanted to rely more on his social game this time, and I think he tried. For example, early on, he wasn't out looking for idols, but rather was teaching others how to find idols. And he told Mike Bloom that he feels like he did a better job with this aspect throughout the game. They went to so many tribal councils when he was at Cele, and the relationships he built kept him safe. All the way to the swap and then at Yara, once they got Rob out, they really turned it on because of the relationships they built.
I think that this was part of his downfall too, though, was that he was trying so hard to have a social game and to have people mm-hmm. that he was building, not just an alliance with, but also a friendship with, that it was negatively affecting his ability to strategize in the game, which we've already talked about. So I do think that to his credit, he wanted to play a social game because he learned from his last game that he didn't do so well mm-hmm. there. And so it was like he overcompensated this time in focusing so much on having a social, really, you know, like a friendship, really. I mean, he wasn't pretending to be nice. He really wanted to be nice because he really wanted to have a special bond with people after leaving the season, that it just, it negatively affected his ability to play the game in a strategic way.
Yeah. And let's face it, it wasn't all butterflies and roses for his social game anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw him sniping at Adam fairly often. We discussed how this happened with Jeremy, too. When Chrissy was on the recap podcast, she said that what happened with Adam and Ben happened with her and Ben just a little later in the game, where Ben became unbearable. Mm-hmm. It seems like he was better this time, but he admitted in interviews that he could have improved his social game more. And he sometimes acted like a human to people outside his alliance instead of acting like a survivor player, which is he allowed his true feelings to show.
Yes. And I think that that's part of that balance that he wasn't really able to figure out, where someone like Tony knew that I pretend to be nice. You know, I need to form these relationships with people, but I'm not going to react if they tell me something and that's, they're dead set in that. Okay. That's what you want to do. So he was able to keep it in game mode, even though I feel like Ben was losing sight of that, where he, as you said, acted as a human. You know, sometimes in Survivor, you have to keep that in check. And even though you might not agree with what that person is saying, you have to just kind of go along with it in order to benefit yourself down the road and do what Tony was doing, do what Sarah was doing. And he was more focused on having friendships with those particular people, that he was losing sight of the benefit of having relationships with other people in his game.
Yeah. All right. Rounding out this rule, Denise clearly had a good social game as well, but like so much else, we often didn't get to see it. We knew she had an alliance with Ben early, but then we were surprised to find out late that they were practically like brother and sister.
Right.
It's like, poof.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, where'd that come from?
Yeah.
We have no idea. I kept thinking she was on the fringe, and then again, poof, we found out she was part of the core alliance. I do wish we'd seen more of that, but I think we can give her credit here that, you know, she seemingly deserves.
Yes. I mean, and we've talked about it previously. I mean, loyalty is one of the big parts that comes with Denise. You know, she is a loyal person, even though she was able to separate and say, okay, now I've got it. This Adam's done. Jeremy's done. But I do think that she is someone who is able to look at the game as a whole and say, okay, this is a beneficial relationship to me. But she's also going to have that person's back. And we've seen her do that in her previous season. We've seen her do it now. But I do think a lot of it kind of came as a surprise. I mean, her closeness to Ben was not something that we saw throughout the season, which is unfortunate because clearly it was significant and it was working.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that that was part of the reason, unfortunately, why she got sent home, was because there was a concern that she would be unwilling to turn on Ben. And
right.
For her, that was to her detriment, clearly, because she got voted out.
Yeah. All right. The seventh rule covers idols and advantages. And while Tony was known for his idol finding coming into the season, we already discussed how he toned that down early. But once he got everybody feeling calm about himself, he told Mike Bloom, "They didn't show it, but every single night I was out looking for idols. While everyone was sleeping, I'd tend to the fire, and I would show people I was tending to the fire. So if they woke up and I wasn't there, they'd assume I'd gone to the bathroom or something. But I would disappear every single night. For 26 days, I was searching for an idol." And of course, he did find one.
And I have to give him a great big, like, kudos, the shell with the, you know, putting the coals in the shell.
Yeah, make your own flashlight.
Oh my gosh. I'm like this. It was incredible to see that. And then starting a fire in another part of the island so you could look for idols on that section, almost burning down the whole island. But
yeah.
Really, I mean, incredible gameplay, because I've always kind of thought to myself, boy, it's dark out there. You know, like, how do they all find idols in the middle of the night? And Tony just took it to a different level with a, you know, handmade, you know, flashlight with the coals. And it was incredible, really incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what we really didn't know was that Tony's idol strategy went far beyond this. He told interviewers that he made a fake idol that he showed Nick to make him think he had two idols. Now, this is somewhat eye-opening and helps provide some good reasons that Nick didn't go against Tony. Both because Tony said he'd use one idol for Nick if necessary, and also because even if they flushed one of the idols, Nick thought he had another. You know, last week I mentioned that Aurora McCreary's tweet saying anyone else feeling like this cast did not watch Ghost Island and two powerful players getting to the end and having other players just do what they want. I further noted that everybody but Tony and Sarah should be getting together to get rid of that duo, and indicated instead they were distracted by picking off one another. Mm-hmm. This is what I said last week.
Yep.
But it turns out there was a slightly different parallel to Wendell and Dominic. If Nick thought Tony had two idols, and he might have told others, like at least Michelle, then that made it a very difficult proposition to target them, again, like what happened in Ghost Island.
Right, and he gave a fake idol to Sarah. So that's one right. other, you know, level to all of this, where then Sarah was able to utilize that to take the target off of herself. So their ability to utilize fake idols in that way, and because honestly, I mean, all the idols look fake now anyway. So it's one of those, like, I, you know, and I think Michelle even thought, or was, I think it was Michelle thought that, like, if Natalie's idol, somebody said they thought that hers might even be fake because of what it looked like. And so they're not.
Well, and Denise thought Sandra's idol was
fake. That's what it was. I knew that I had read that yeah. somewhere. So because they're not things that look like.
They're not fleur-de-lis.
No, they're definitely not. They're just random little pieces of wood that come on every piece of tree mail that, you know, so it was interesting to see that response that, you know, you can actually use the fact that these idols look like fake idols to your advantage by making fake idols.
Yeah, which I think is their point.
Oh, for sure.
You know, I think that's why they've done that.
For sure.
Now, you know, Tony's understanding of the idol and advantage game went even further. Sarah noted in her Jury Speaks video that he knew who had idols and advantages, and he was the only one who knew Natalie likely had an idol when she returned and wanted to plan for it. Sarah and Ben were certain she didn't. You know, we brought this up already. And after post-game interviews, we now know that's largely because they didn't think production would make the same mistake twice by giving the returnee an idol.
Yeah.
Well, production showed them that they were, in fact, willing to repeat they that were. Error.
And I don't. And I want to mention something here because I think this is interesting. Tony mentioned in his exit press that in regards to Natalie coming back in with an idol, that part of Natalie's ability to purchase an idol probably came from the fact that he paid her 6 tokens
yes.
for a disadvantage. And he says, now, if I had known that she had the ability to purchase an idol, I wouldn't have paid her for that disadvantage because I actually gave her an ability when she came back in the game to stay in the game because she had an idol. I thought that was fascinating. Like that, mm-hmm. look at that, you know, that you're actually having that effect on the players who are paying these people who are then purchasing things that they can use when they get back in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was one of Natalie's arguments, not to jump ahead myself, was that, you know, she and other people said, well, she had a lot of influence in the game. Well, you and I would say, yeah, but she shouldn't have.
exactly.
But, you know, she did, like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Natalie, she's next up here. And of course, she came in with the idol she bought, and then she found another one, and that's all well and good. But then we get to a different area that we're also covering in this rule, and that's Final Four firemaking.
Mm.
Yeah, Natalie chose to have Sarah and Tony go up against each other, which seemed like a perfectly smart thing to do. Then she got criticized for it at Final Tribal Council, which is absolutely bizarre to me. She made a correct strategic decision that should have been applauded. Did the winners who were against this forget that this is Survivor, not the Campfire Girls? Mm-hmm. You know, it's smart to do what you can to get your biggest threat out. And she felt Sarah had a better shot of doing that than she did herself. Survivor is a strategic social game. It's not a fire making game.
Right.
I mean, I know people are used to hearing us rant about Edge of Extinction, but before that, we ranted about Final Four fire making.
Mm-hmm.
And she used a strategy to pit two strong allies against each other and knock one out.
Right. But But this, I'm going to go back to the thing I've already mentioned about keeping Ben in the game would have been the better move.
Well, yes.
Because if you are really thinking about Final Four, fire making, who's the most likely to beat Tony in a fire making challenge, mm-hmm. if you know that it might not be you and you're unsure of Sarah or Michelle's ability to do so, but you know Ben is going to kill everybody at fire making, and they actually discussed Ben, and that's, I mean, she said point blank, I do not want to go up against Ben in fire making. But it's one of those situations where if everyone knows that Tony is the main guy that's got to go, you know, he's going to end up making fire against somebody unless he's the one wearing the immunity necklace. And so I just feel like that was a call that she shouldn't have made, you know, that was not the right move at that point, because if you want to beat Tony in fire making, Ben's the guy that's going to do it.
Right. Yeah. But now that you're here and you don't have Ben, you know, she's getting this criticism. And when I mentioned this on Twitter, some people responded that she needed to show agency in the game. Okay, fine. She needs to show agency. Showing agency in the game of Survivor is making the best strategic decision. If she didn't think she could knock out Tony in fire, the best strategic decision was to have his ally fight him for it. Sarah told Entertainment Weekly that she convinced Natalie she could beat Tony in fire making. And Jeff Probst told the magazine, I think it was clear that she didn't feel confident enough in her fire making skills to take out Tony. So she put someone up against her who should have been against him, but that's Jeff's quote, against him who she thought might be able to take him out. Had she been right, and she almost was, that would have been another move she could add to her resume. It's not often that Jeff and I agree, but I do this time. Fire making isn't part of the game that anyone should be arguing. Strategy and social game are key.
But here's the thing, though, and here's the problem with that is now, unfortunately,
there are no problems with that.
Oh, fire making is now a component of the Final Four. So it is something that people have to think about. And if Sarah had beaten Tony in fire making, then Sarah would have sat there in the final saying, I beat Tony making fire. And she would have gotten credit for taking out Tony in that moment. So I don't think that the decision that Natalie made would have overshadowed Sarah beating Tony. I think that Natalie could have said, hey, you know what? But I'm the one that pitted them against each other. And Sarah would have said, yeah, you were too, excuse my language, you were too chicken. I'll say that you were too chicken to do it yourself. You were too afraid. So I had to do it. I had to take Tony out. And I just feel like it would have spiraled and worked against Natalie. So
it might have, but my argument is it shouldn't have.
Well,
whatever it would have,
right? But
it shouldn't have, because you know, Allie Lasher said on the feedback show, it's ridiculous that winning Final Immunity Challenge makes things worse for you because you're expected to put yourself at risk to make fire, which is stupid. When Eric Reichenbach gave up his immunity necklace and was voted off, the move was derided as one of the worst ever. They still bring it up. Poor Eric. Now I'm doing it. But now some people on the jury expect it.
Yeah.
They expect you to take that off and give it away. No, screw you. I know Natalie said in interviews that the one thing she regrets is not going to fire against Tony, but she shouldn't. Don't give in to that. She made the right decision, and the jurors who criticized it are the ones who were wrong here. And I know that there are some who say the jurors are never wrong because they're allowed to set the criteria that they're looking for. But no, I disagree. That's a dumb criteria, and all future jurors should be discouraged from thinking the same way.
But.
No, but. I'm done. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Is it possible that the reason that they were looking at it that way is because of the Edge of Extinction? Because if you think about
we can go back
to Dominic and Wendell. And Dominic didn't go against Wendell making fire. And that's something that has kicked himself, you know, since going, should I have done that myself? But he wasn't discredited for the play, you know, Wendell ended up winning by one vote. So I feel like maybe the reason for it is the Edge of Extinction is that because you are already out of the game, you've been voted out, you're on Edge of Extinction, you managed to get back in. You have to do everything, you know, to prove yourself the sole survivor. And in order to do that, you have to do everything. And I'm curious if it's because of the Edge of Extinction And I know Rob actually talked about this, you know, Chris Underwood kind of like set the stage now for anybody playing on Edge and moving forward, that that's what is going to be deemed a perfect game, is that you have to dominate, you have to win immunities, you have to have an idol, you got to make fire. And I feel like there is something there, because we don't like the Edge of Extinction component and what it's doing to the game. And perhaps that's why the fire making becomes more significant for someone like Natalie, because she came from the Edge.
Yeah, but to me, that makes it even less significant. So they're trying to offset one twist with another twist.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, she's back in the game. She should be playing the game. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the game is the strategic game. And the strategic game says, this is what I want to do to set myself up, not I want to give away immunity.
Mm-hmm. No, and I don't discount that. But I just feel like maybe that's where it comes from, because even Rob said it, that Natalie said she was going to need to play a perfect game in order to win. And in his mind, a perfect game included her going to fire. I don't think that a perfect game for someone who was playing the game all 39 days included making fire. I think Tony would have won even if he hadn't gone to fire, if he's sitting in the final three. So I think that idea that the perfect game includes making fire and winning fire at final four is someone coming off of the Edge.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you're right, that it's just because of the Edge, because this is not something that should continue where everybody in the jury thinks, oh, you have to make fire in order to win. No, that's dumb.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, and the other thing too is there, and perhaps moving forward, if people want to avoid that being the issue, you know, when you get to that moment in the decision, when you have to explain to Jeff who's doing what, you need to be very clear to the jury why you're making that decision. You know, mm-hmm. and maybe Natalie should have done a better job explaining that, you know, I'm not going to do this because I want to take these two who are, you know, they've been a duo the entire time. They've been making decisions together the entire time. And I want to pit them against each other and knock one of them out. You know, I do think that maybe she could have sold that a little bit better to the jury as to why she wasn't doing it, because in their mind, that's what they thought was a perfect game.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I do understand the irony of me defending the Edge of Extinction returnee against people saying that another twist she should have done, you know. So, but hey, we've said it all along. We look at these things objectively, mm-hmm. and it doesn't matter. You know, I'm just looking at it from the standpoint, because I got some people on Twitter like, huh? You know, from the standpoint of her game and what the jury should have been looking at, that's how I'm arguing it here, or have been. All right, moving to the rest of the final six, I think the only other one who deserves special mention is Denise for the use of her idol plus Sandra's idol to knock out the queen. You know, first, the planning and execution was excellent. Even beyond that, after it happened, Sandra said in a video on social media that based on how Denise was acting, never in a million years would she have thought that Denise had her own idol. So good for Denise.
Denise was amazing in this moment. It really was one of my favorite moments, because I feel like people get very excited when they're about to do something, when they're playing this game, and there's a tendency to want to share information. She never told anybody that she had an idol. So that was kudos to her, because it is something that.
Well, except Adam.
Oh, she did tell Adam. That's right. All right. But was Adam.
She almost told Parvati.
She almost told Parvati. But
until Adam said, boy, that would be a dumb idea.
That would be a dumb idea. So she did tell someone. So she fell into that. I got excited about having an idol. But nobody that she was on that swap tribe with knew that she had an idol. So she at least the information was contained, if you will, with just Adam.
Yes.
So, and at least the person she told was someone she was playing the game with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So strategically, maybe it made sense for her, but it is something that I feel like a lot of people get excited about, is that now they're going to do something. And the fact that she was able to keep it in check, she was very calm going into that tribal. I mean, even sitting at that tribal, she was acting very calm. And even when she played the idol, she was very calm about it. You know, she didn't tell Jeremy that she was going to play an idol for him. So she kept him out of the loop. So I feel like.
So much so that he voted.
I know, but I have to. But it's one of those things where I feel like that type of move, when you know that you're doing it, to keep it all contained was very impressive. And so I do have to give her some serious props for keeping everything in check. And I know that some people have argued that her idol play for Jeremy was a waste of an idol. But I think under the circumstances, it was the right move for her at that time, because she didn't know which one they were targeting. And he was the only other half that she had at that moment. So she needed to protect him, even though he had flipped on her. So, you know, I don't think that was a bad call for her at all.
No, I agree. So I didn't have any other thoughts for the other players for this rule. Did you?
Not really. I mean.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So Appendix A is about the rest of the tribe keeping their end goals in mind when voting. And of course, at this point in the game, every vote was crucial. But that said, not a whole lot to discuss here. We already talked about the choice to vote out Denise instead of Sarah, which was basically thanks to Sarah convincing Natalie that she'd be more likely to flip. And we've also discussed Ben giving Sarah permission to vote him out. But it raises actually the interesting question that, well, you've kind of already brought up, which was, did she end up costing herself the game by doing it? So you've already gone over this, but just to make it official and address it here in Appendix A, if she had voted out Michelle, then Natalie would almost certainly have had to put Ben up against Tony in firemaking for another likely Ben win. That would have knocked out Tony, leaving Sarah to claim credit for all their moves, like you said. I don't know if she would have beaten Natalie for certain. I think she would have, personally. There's other people out there who are like, Natalie would have absolutely beaten her. I think that Sarah would have won in that situation. We'll never know.
Unfortunately, because it's all of these other things. The stars have to align differently. But I do think that what would have helped Sarah at that moment, too, would have been Tony being on the jury. Because Tony would have been then telling them, well, this is everything that we did. I mean, she said that Tony would have fought just as hard for her as she fought for Tony with that group of people. So I do think that there is something to be said about Tony being on the jury and providing a whole slew of information to that group who were very hungry for information. I mean, we saw when Denise came back and at Ponderosa, how they just all kind of pounced on her, you know, wanting to know what was happening. And so I think that he would have given them a wealth of information and really sold it for Sarah. So I do think that if that had happened, there's a very, very strong likelihood that she would have just dominated in a final three if it had ended up with she and Natalie and Ben.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now on to Appendix B, which talks about the jury phase and the actions leading up to it. I actually want to start with someone who didn't make the final three, and that would be Sarah, because she was already working the jury several days ahead of time. She told Entertainment Weekly that she made her push at final six because, you know, what she was doing wasn't being perceived as big play. So she had to start campaigning for a win ahead of time.
Yeah, she mentioned specifically that when you get to day 39, most people come into that with a decision already made. The jury is walking in with an idea of who they're going to vote for before they even hear what those final three players have to say. And that's true. I mean, I can attest to that. So I think it was very smart of her to play up to the jury ahead of time what she was doing and the game that she was presenting, and really providing an idea for them to kind of mull over in their brains as they went back and started talking about the various people and who could be sitting there and the games that they're playing. Great for her to be doing that and be mindful of it so many days in advance.
Yeah. Now, moving to the three who did make it to Final Tribal Council, I have to say, I don't know if there's anything Natalie could have done to win at that point, in part because of what you just said. 12-4 is a big hill to overcome. And a number of jurors came in with the same thoughts I would have had, according to their Jury Speaks video. Sophie said, you can't discount the fact that she did get voted out of the game. That's a big flaw. She was the first person voted out of her tribe. Adam said, if you got voted out of the game, it can only be seen as a negative. Amber even said that though they spent so much time together on the edge, she's not sure the person who came from the edge should be the winner of Winners at War. Denise needed justification of how being on the edge made Natalie equal to someone playing the whole time. And Kim wanted to vote for the person who played the best game. Rob did say Natalie played the Edge better than anyone else. But several of them noted that playing the Edge isn't the same as playing Survivor. That's what we talked about at the top of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And Natalie didn't have much to say about playing the actual game because she just wasn't there that
way. Yeah. And I think that that's really incredible that when you look at that final three, and when she's asked about, you know, the outwit, outplay, outlast portion, I mean, she's really limited in what she can say, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she didn't outlast and outwit and outplay because it was one day that she could essentially talk about. So I appreciate the fact that so many of the jury members in their Jury Speaks video acknowledge that. I mean, and I really did love Adam's take on it, that you really can't compare the two because they were literally different games. And this isn't the Edge. That's not the game. The game is Survivor. And I do think, and I'll go back to what I've already said about this, is that you are playing with everything that's being presented to you. And the Edge was a component that was presented to these players this season, but you still can't discount what the actual game of Survivor has always been.
Right.
Outwit, outplay, outlast. And so I am happy that there was an appreciation for that. I mean, granted, Natalie killed it on the Edge. She's a beast. She's incredibly strong. The things that she was able to do, I mean, just run laps around people out there. Incredible. Absolutely amazing. But I do feel like there's this built-in problem with the Edge and having all of those people become the jury for the mere fact that all of those people are sitting there wanting to get back in the game, right? All of them are like thinking to themselves, I can get back in the game and I can win. And if they're all sitting there thinking that, then having someone in a final three who has been living through that with them, they're probably still mindful of that. Well, like, you know, as they're sitting there, like, I'm sure Rob Cesarnino, or I'm sorry, Rob Cesarnino, Austin Rob is thinking to himself, like, hey, if I had made it back in, I would be telling them I should win because I fought really hard on the Edge and I got back in. So there's this inherent like mindset already that someone from the Edge could win, because when you're sitting on the Edge, you want to believe that you could win.
Yeah. And it's something we discussed when Chris Underwood won this. If you discount that, then you're discounting yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and the brain just doesn't work that way often. But yeah, luckily it did for most of them. You know, they understood that. And, you know, contrary to Natalie, Tony did have a lot to talk about. You know, he told Mike Bloom that he hoped his game would speak for itself, but he still had to discuss it. He wanted to avoid rubbing people the wrong way, so he tried to say as little as possible and danced around things very gingerly. As he was going along, he realized that the jury was laughing and they were very receptive, and I felt he was absolutely playing to them. You know, he was playing to his audience with his humor and his stories, the Spiness discussion. I mentioned earlier that he might not have gotten much information from the Spiness itself, but he certainly entertained the jury when he talked about it. And that may have been his greatest positive he took away from it. He also said in interviews that he talked about how he tried his best to be a great player for the season as kind of a way to remind the jury that they were voting for the winner of an all-winner season.
Yes, for sure. And he did this in every single tribal council. I mean, he would go to tribal council and he would own tribal councils because he's mindful of the fact that the only thing that they're seeing is what happens at tribal council. It's not like they're going and watching what's happening on the beach. They're seeing this production, if you will, at tribal. And he was able to really come across as a boss, as we saw Boston Rob point out, you know, that he was really in control at tribal, which then resonates with the jury. And they think to themselves, well, then he must be in control in the game itself because he's controlling tribal council. So he was very aware of the perception that they were going to have of him with how he presented himself in front of the jury. And so he really did great jury management there. And I do think that his final tribal council was great because he, again, thought about that. How do I want to speak to the people that I had a hand in voting out? And he spoke to them very well and really was. I mean, I've never seen a final tribal council where there's so much laughter. I mean, there was an insane amount of laughter coming from that jury.
Yeah. you know, and the other key thing that Tony did, and Michelle did this as well, was they learned the lesson from the original Edge of Extinction season, and they didn't criticize the Edge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They saw how those jurors from 38 turned on the finalists who dared suggest that the Edge wasn't as hard or as good as the actual game. So that was what, you know, a part of what Tony danced around, as I mentioned a moment ago. Indeed, Rob said in his jury speaks that Tony needed to own his game and not cry about the person coming back from the Edge.
Oh, and I think that that was great because it was very clear with some of the questions that were being posed by the jury that the Edge was something that they were considering, you know, that they were mm-hmm. they were talking a lot about it. They were giving Natalie credit for the things that she did. So Tony and Michelle really did listen to all of that and were very mindful of we cannot discredit all of those people who were sitting there who did exactly what Natalie did, but she was able to get back in the game. She suffered with them. They suffered too. So it was nice because there was almost like a respect for the jury because we know what you went through and we respect it. We respect Natalie. However, this is what, you know, the whole game encompassed.
Right. And I did feel like Michelle also did a good job with her jury answers, but she just didn't have as good a story to tell as far as the jurors were mm-hmm. concerned. Throughout the podcast, we've talked about the jurors saying they wanted to see a player who controlled the game, and Michelle couldn't say that. She argued her points, and I think they were decent ones and certainly a valid way to play the game, but she wasn't going to be able to win over a jury sitting next to Tony.
Yes, and I do think that there's been some discussion about her not getting any votes and Natalie getting votes. And there was an interesting computation mm-hmm. being done where she found out some people did want to vote for her, but there was a concern that if they voted for her, then there were votes going to Natalie and that somehow Natalie could accidentally end up winning because they wanted to try to give Michelle second place. So people were doing the math, it sounds like, in their votes that they were putting forth because they mm-hmm. wanted to make sure that the right person won and not the right person got second.
Yeah. And that, I mean, honestly, that's what the jury should be doing anyway. They should be voting for the yes. winner. They shouldn't be trying to give, I won't call them pity votes, but second place mm-hmm. votes.
No, I
agree. You know, they should just be voting for
right.
the winner.
And I agree. I mean, that's what we did in our season. You know, I mean, if people look at yeah. Adam's win and say, well, he got all 10 votes. Well, because he was the clear winner out of those three. So people wanted to vote for the winner. Because that's what you're mm-hmm. doing. You're voting for the winner. You're not voting for second place.
Right. All right. Before we wrap things up with our conclusion here, let me remind everyone that the rules we just discussed are available in both poster and t-shirt form. So for the shirt, go to robhasawebsite.com or robhasapodcast.com and click on the merch link and then sort to see newer items first. For the poster, go to tinyurl.com/DavidRulesPoster2. And remember, we'll be donating the proceeds of each poster sale for just a few more days.
Yes, and you should definitely buy it for $20. If you are outside of the United States, you can contact me. You can DM me through Twitter, and I will definitely make arrangements to get those to you. International shipping to some countries has stopped as of late, as some of you might know. Yeah, I found this out because I've asking every time I get a request to send one to in like Australia, I've had a request, but I think the mail is a little bit slow, so we're going to hold off on that one. But there, yes, some of them have been shut down, but don't worry, even if that's a thing, we'll get it to you at some point. Don't worry, we'll definitely yes. work around
all right that. All right, so with all of this behind us, with 2 hours and 15 minutes behind us here, what are your final thoughts?
All right. I'm not going to go as long as I think you are as final thoughts, but I just wanted to throw a couple of things out there. Well, because I know you're going to blow it out of the water. So what I did was I went back and I was looking at what did all of these players say pregame as to how they were going to play the game? Because I think it was really interesting to see what they said pregame and then how their games ended up turning out. Tony's strategy going in was I'm going to be quiet. There are enough personalities out there that I can sit back and watch them, which I think Tony actually did that, which is pretty impressive. Natalie, I thought this was really quite fascinating. She said the last time revenge was what propelled her through the game because her sister Nadia got voted out first. So she mm-hmm. said, this time I got to figure out what is going to push me through what's going to fire me up? And I was like, well, isn't that interesting that what ended up happening was being voted out first and ending up on the edge was what gave her the motivation and propelled her all the way through. Michelle, to play really adaptable, really flexible, that's my goal in this game, to keep an open mind, and all my doors and windows will be open if you want to come inside. And I think we saw Michelle do the same thing. She was very flexible, very willing to work with whoever she needed to work with because she was playing from the bottom. Sarah, I feel like I have a target. People are looking at me like a criminal and I have to behave for a little bit until I can get off of probation. So again, we saw Sarah going in with that mindset that she's going to have to be aware of the threat level that she's coming in, the target, which we talked about. A lot of people targeted her straight off the bat and she was able to minimize that entirely. Ben, I want to build relationships so I don't have to rely on being on my own, which I thought was very telling because that's what we ended up seeing. And unfortunately to Ben, that ended up becoming his biggest downfall in the game, was relying too heavily on those alliance relationships he was able to create. And Denise, nobody thinks I'm a big strategic player. I definitely want to lean into that. I'd love to be able to play more strategically, but I don't want anyone to know that I am. I want them to think that I'm loyal. And I think we saw Denise do the same thing. I mean, obviously with her taking out the queen was a very big strategic move that I don't think anybody saw Denise pulling off, and she pulled it off beautifully. So I think what I was able to learn by going back through all of those pre-game conversations and interviews was that each of these players really came in with a different idea of how they wanted to play this game and how to best present themselves to this group of winners. Unfortunately, for some of them, it worked out better than others. I mean, clearly, Tony just did an impeccable job of revamping himself in a group full of winners to really pull it out for this season. I don't think anybody would have ever expected a Tony win from an all-winners season, because we were very aware of the target that he was coming in with and the way that we saw him go out in Game Changers. So the fact that he was able to change so many aspects of not only his game, but also himself in order to win is huge. I have crazy respect for the guy. I think he is a wonderful representation for this season. I think that he did an amazing job. I think everybody on this season was so incredible to watch. It was so much fun. It was so great kind of reliving those moments from very early on, seeing someone like Ethan come back and just really be developed into this character that we can all appreciate and love was such a wonderful thing to watch. So thank you to all of them for giving us an amazing season. Thank you to the final six for wrapping it all up nicely for us. And congratulations to Tony for an amazing win. And I would love to hear everything you have to say about them, David. So that's what I will leave it there and let you go.
All right. Yeah. Tony broke the mold for returning player season, similar to the way he broke the mold in his original win. After Kagyan, he was often called a unicorn, one of a kind. Nobody else could do what he did, but he proved that he could. Often it's the under the radar types who win full returning player seasons, but Tony wasn't going to let that happen. He learned from his Game Changers mistakes and did an amazing job correcting them. Natalie deserves credit for playing the game that was put in front of her. She did indeed play a great edge game. And if she isn't a spokesperson for CrossFit soon, somebody is missing out on a great advertising opportunity. But the edge game is not Survivor. And she was voted out first before coming back. She simply did not have enough time to play a game that could in any way be compared to Tony's. And she wasn't able to get rid of him. Michelle played a flexible game, found cracks, and moved around in them wherever she could. She survived to the final three, and in some seasons could have made a good argument about her game, but not against Tony. She said in her social media Q&A that Tony was playing the best game, and she was scared crapless that she'd have to sit next to him at the end. We all see why. Sarah was Tony's partner throughout the entire game. It is a shame we didn't see more of specifically what she was doing, but I have no doubt that she played a big role in the moves that were made. She schemed and plotted, kept her emotions out of it, and went almost all the way to the end with a solid alliance. Ben was the third member of that solid alliance, and he accomplished many of the goals he set out for himself. Unfortunately, he could not fully fix his social game and lack of flexibility, and left a bad taste with many of the jurors, to the point that he knew he wouldn't win and allowed himself to be sacrificed. Denise was the queen slayer, but as I said in Rule 6, that was not the reason she was voted out. Denise was part of a solid alliance running the game until it had to be broken up, and in the minds of Natalie and Michelle, she was too close with Ben to keep around, while Sarah convinced those two it was better to work with her than Denise. But it all circles back to Tony. I want to go through some of what those who played closest to him said about his game in their Jury Speaks videos and interviews. Sophie said it was hard to find a flaw with his game. He dictated the pace of the game, won immunities, and blindsided people without them feeling personally got. Denise said, "Tony, for me, epitomizes what Survivor is all about. He is the strategizing, chaotic, conniving player who's still able to have these social relationships in the midst of it all." She added, "Tony was so good at the game that he played. There's nobody else to me that represented this 40th season of Survivor any more than Tony did." Sarah said Tony was a well-rounded player who encompassed everything you need to win. After it was all over, she added, "Tony played the perfect game. His name wasn't written down once. He won 4 immunity challenges. He found an idol. Quite honestly, I'm shocked he didn't win unanimously. To the people who didn't vote for him, my question is," and this is her, this is quoting here, "my question is, what more did he need to do to earn your vote? Win 10 immunities? Find 10 idols? I don't know what more he could have done." That was a Sarah quote. Tony himself said, "You have to do a little of everything." And he did. Strategy, social game, challenges. Everything he did was to keep the target off his back. He led votes without anybody knowing. He never got a vote, and he tried his best to be a great player for the season. Tony, you succeeded. Tony talked about lions and hyenas, his metaphor for the most threatening players and the less threatening players. And he knew he had to target those we called the most threatening, least threatening people to keep them from coming together and getting rid of him and his allies. In the end, he ended up being the most threatening player. Yet nobody ever seriously tried to get rid of him until Final Four fire making. We've seen it before, but never to this extent. As a player, you can't let someone like this get to the end after they've already showed how much they were controlling the game and won over the jury. Tony did everything he needed to win, starting even before the game began, as he plotted out his path to success. And he followed that path all the way through. And that is why Tony won, Michelle, Sarah, Ben, and Denise lost, and Natalie lost again.
Throw that in there one more time. That was an incredible wrap up. Very nice. Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Can't believe it's over. It's over.
I know. Well, it's not over for us.
No.
It's not over for us. But as we wrap up this podcast, I do want to encourage people to check out the RHAP patron program at robhasawebsite.com/patron. We've mentioned multiple times Rob donated April and then, you know, so far in May subscriptions to Direct Relief, the organization that provides protective equipment to doctors and nurses. And he matched that donation. So, you know, everybody hurry up and become a patron. Mm-hmm. Once you join, you'll see how, you know, active Rob is with the community. He does at least 9 patron only call-in shows a month. He's got patron trivia once a week, weekly Q&A shows with Nicole. Several shows have been live streaming to the patrons. Plus, if the world ever gets back to normal, there are discounts and first access to live show tickets, you know. And in the meantime, there are the Facebook groups to keep everybody occupied with this great community of people, including both of us. Remember, go to robhasawebsite.com/patron. Once you get to the Facebook groups, make sure to say
yes. And it's an incredible group of people who clearly love Survivor and all other types of TV shows that Rob does podcasts on. There's so many at this point, I can't even keep track. But yes, you should definitely join because you can talk about all of those things that we all love and enjoy watching together. Also, you should follow myself and David on Twitter. I am at JessicaLewis89 and David is at David Bloomberg. You should follow us both. We do live tweet during the episodes. Unfortunately, now that's over, but that doesn't mean Twitter is over. So follow us anyway, because we will definitely be on Twitter. And again, I'm at JessicaLewis89 and he is at David Bloomberg.
And speaking of Twitter, we do need a hashtag. And although I thought of several clever things that we talked about here, traditionally, we simply hashtag it with the winner. So it would be why Tony won.
Yeah, he deserves it.
He deserves it. So everybody use that hashtag. And of course, there's the hashtag for this podcast overall, YX Lost. Everyone should make sure you're subscribed to all of the RHAP Survivor podcasts. There's still some more coming out. All of the deep dive interviews, however many there are, those will be coming out. So, you know, that's at robhasapodcast.com/survivor or just go to your favorite podcatcher. We are also on the reality TV wrap ups feed, which covers a number of other shows too. In both places, you'll find great content, the Know It Alls, the Wiggle Room, the B&B, This Week in Survivor, and much more.
There's so much.
Yes, there is.
And we also need to say thank you so much to Scott St. Pierre for all of the editing that he does on Why Blank Lost, both the audio and video version. So thank you for that. And also to Will from America for the wonderful theme song that you hear before the audio version of the show.
Oh, I forgot I was going to sing it before the finale.
Were you really? Look at that. That would have been great. You could still do it. You do it right now.
No, I can't remember the words.
So thank you to both of those fine gentlemen for doing all of the work that they've done for us and continues every week. So thank you for that. We do appreciate it. It's been an incredible season and we are almost done. We've got like one more show to go. But yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. This has been fun.
Yeah, and thank you for a great season, a great week, a great season, a great everything. And yeah, as you know, we mentioned, we will have the special postseason Q&A. And then after that, we're going to find some way to return in the not too distant future. We're not entirely sure what it is. We had some plans, but then TV schedules changed, things changed. And, you know, it's really hard to plan without knowing what's actually going on. But we have some ideas for some special podcasts. So even after the postseason Q&A, and a reminder, get your questions in. But even after that, We're going to check in with you somehow.
Yeah, because I feel like right now it's really hard to plan anything because so much is just kind of up in the air. Like, when are people going to go back to work? When is life going to return to semi-normal existence? Who knows? But we will definitely do everything we can to get through this together and also come back and see you again at some point in some fashion for something. I don't know.
So, all right. Well, with all that in mind, you know, everybody, we will see you in about a week for the Q&A show.
Bye.
Bye.
If you lost Survivor and you're feeling down, David and Jessica will turn it around. They'll break down the rules and they'll show you how. You played yourself and got voted out. This is why Blank lost. This is why Blank lost. Oh, baby, this is why Blank lost.